You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Because while ultimately this is a scientific issue, are vaccines safe? Are they effective? Are they necessary? Are there other things we can do? That's all science questions. The way it plays out in our lives day to day is a legal question. At any given point in time, when somebody's required to get a vaccine, there's either a law that says you can say no or there isn't. So where the rubber meets the road primarily is in the state legislature. So we've got to become legislatively involved, whether we like that or not. And we've got to be proactive pushing our agenda for informed choice, because whether we do that or not, they're pushing their agenda backed by huge sums of money and lobbyists and so forth.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Alan Phillips. Today's show, Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. Alan Phillips is a practicing attorney headquartered in North Carolina. He is a nationally recognized legal expert on vaccine policy and law. He is the only attorney in the United States whose practice is focused solely on vaccine exemptions and waivers and vaccine legislative activism. He advises individuals, families, attorneys, legislators, and legislative activists throughout the U.S. on vaccine exemption and waiver rights and vaccine politics and law. He hosts a weekly radio show, The Vaccine Agenda. He is the author of The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, published as an ebook. Guns and Butter co-producer Tony Rango caught up with Alan Phillips for an update on the current vaccination legal and political environment, its effects on doctors and healthcare workers, students and employees, as well as related industries, including medical publishing and pharmaceuticals. We begin with the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act that granted legal protection to the vaccine industry.
Alan Phillips, welcome to Guns and Butter.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here.
You are in a very unique position to discuss vaccine exemptions, since you are the only lawyer in the U.S. with a practice that focuses specifically on legal exemptions. And I know there's a lot you have to share with our listeners on this topic, especially in light of recent California legislation mandating vaccines, SB 277 for children and SB 792 for adults. There are two areas. The first is corruption, an area you've been covering lately. The other is legal and legislative issues, which also include exemptions. Take us through the legal environment in which the vaccine industry operates that provides opportunity and what appears to be incentive to be corrupted. What did the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act change?
Well, first of all, we need to understand why that 1986 Act was passed. And the pharmaceutical industry was going out of business, not the pharmaceutical industry, but the vaccine manufacturing portion of the pharmaceutical industry. Was going out of business in the early 1980s, mid-1980s. They were pulling out of the vaccine business. There was the court awards for vaccine injury and death were too many and too high. And Congress stepped in to save that industry. We really have to question, I think, whether there was a need to save anything there. But this was all in kind of this broad premise about how vaccines are necessary. That's an irrefutable fact, so we're not even going to debate that. Because if it weren't for vaccines, we'd have rampant disease running everywhere and so forth. If you look at the official government statistics, and not only here in the U.S., but also in Great Britain, in Australia, and probably some other countries as well, the mortality decline from childhood infectious diseases dropped steadily across the 1900s, a period of decades. And that drop was on average about 90 to 90% before vaccines were even introduced in the first place. So vaccines may have had and may have some impact on disease incidence, but not on disease mortality. We do not have low disease death rates with regard to the childhood infectious diseases today because of vaccines. Vaccines had nothing to do with that. The vast majority of that decline preceded the introduction of vaccines. So I would question the need for anybody to do anything, decide to try and protect the vaccine industry. If their products don't stand on their own merits, they should either fix the products or get out of the business. And there's a whole other category question about whether or not there are other ways of dealing with childhood infectious diseases. And I'll just mention very, very briefly, because I think it's such an important one that needs to become a bigger part of this conversation. And that is homeoprophylaxis, which is a very particular type of homeopathic remedy that has demonstrated quite successfully in parts of India and in Cuba, among other places in recent years, where they have used homeoprophylaxis on literally millions of people and documented scientifically the results and seen that it has been very effective. And it's a fraction of the cost of conventional allopathic immunizations. It's more effective, and it doesn't have a side effect of injury and death. We know that vaccines cause injury and death. The federal government pays out money every year. Over the last 6 years, the average payout was over $220 million a year, and that's about twice the average annual payout over the life of the program, which is now, in, I think, in its 26th year of paying out money to compensate victims of vaccines. And that number's enormous, Tony, but we know from multiple sources, including people from the FDA and the CDC, but also non-governmental agencies such as the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons and the National Vaccine Information Center, which has conducted independent surveys, we know that roughly only 1 to 10% of the serious vaccine adverse events ever even get reported. And this is not only a serious problem in that it means there's literally no data available for anyone to use to calculate whether there's any net benefit from vaccines. The cynical but informed among us would say that's not an accident, because we see people in the healthcare industry deliberately violating federal laws. A part of that 1986 Act, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, included federal statutes requiring anybody administering a vaccine to give a physical piece of paper to the vaccine recipient or the parent if it's a minor that's being vaccinated. That spells out not only the supposed risks and benefits of vaccines, but more importantly, for purposes of this point, the existence of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which is one of the things that that 1986 Act created. And this is a program that compensates people or families of people who are injured or killed by vaccines. So the vast majority of the injuries and deaths from vaccines are probably not even being reported at all. Again, we have multiple sources, governmental and non-governmental agencies, agreeing, at least in general terms, that the vast majority never even gets reported. We have laws that require doctors, again, another part of this 1986 Act, anyone administering a vaccine, if they see certain events in terms of medical conditions show up within a certain period of time after a vaccine, and has nothing to do with whether the doctor thinks the vaccine has anything to do with it or not. It's not about their professional opinion. If this condition shows up in this amount of time after a vaccine, it has to be reported. And anything in the package inserts listed as a side effect, if that shows up, it has to be reported. And yet the majority of doctors are not reporting.
I've never had a doctor say anything like that to me or give me any information ahead of time. Is that pretty standard, or what's your sense on that?
Well, surveys show that most doctors don't do that, and anecdotal evidence I hear over and over again from people like yourself just now who say no, they've never offered a piece of paper. When my oldest son went in for his first immunization, this would have been over 22 years ago or about 22 years ago, we were handed a piece of paper. And at that point in time, I was not an attorney and I wasn't familiar with this law. I wasn't even aware of vaccine injury or death as a potential reality at that point in time. But I now know, looking back, that the piece of paper the doctor gave me was something he was required by law to give me. But maybe they were more consistent back then, or maybe I just had one of the few who actually did it. But this doctor, you know, it's real interesting. He was out of the room for some period of time for one reason or another, and he came back in, and I had read this paper while he was gone. And I said, "Doctor, it says here that my son's chance of dying from pertussis is 1 in 10 million, but his chance of a serious adverse reaction are about 1 in 1750. And he got very angry with me and raised his voice and was close to yelling at me. And as he says, "It doesn't say that." And he storms out of the room. And as he's closing the door, he says, "I guess I should read that sometime."
Sorry for laughing. I was going to say my understanding is, and what happens in the media instead of actually reporting these, is they demonize the parent who brings in their child who maybe has been vaccine injured to ask that question, and they're ridiculed and told that can't be possible.
Well, to be fair, I rarely have people ever call me up and say, "By the way, I want you to know that everything went smoothly and beautifully. Thanks for being there." You know, people contact me when they have problems. But certainly I hear anecdotally over and over again reports along the lines of what you just described, that many doctors, who knows how many, but many, it's certainly common, are for some reason on this issue, it pulls them out of professional behavior. I don't think it's an accident, frankly. And Chris, what I've heard from several doctors about medical school, they say, "We're not taught anything about vaccines in medical school except here's the schedule, and vaccines are safe. And by the way, here are some pictures of children dying from these infectious diseases. This is why we need vaccines." So there's an emotional or psychological programming going on. And what doctors have implanted in them at an emotional level is these horrible pictures of children dying from these infectious diseases. And let's not make any mistakes. These infectious diseases have been horrible killers in decades past. You know, 100 years ago, a significant number of children died from, and prior to that time, from these infectious diseases. So they certainly have been problems in the past. But what we are not told, because it's not good marketing, is the fact that the death from these diseases, the death rate declined steadily for decades before vaccines ever came on the scene. So where we are today, you know, before the measles vaccine was first introduced in the years immediately preceding that, the measles was nothing more than a cold with spots. I mean, it was not regarded as something that anybody should be concerned about. Okay, you're sick. Good. Now you'll be done with it. Unlike a cold, it's something you get once and you're done with it. And so it was actually a good thing to get it. And we now know from medical research that getting measles and mumps and these childhood diseases actually protects from certain kinds of cancers and other chronic diseases later on in life. So it's beneficial to get, especially as a child, these childhood infectious diseases. And there was no problem with getting them until after there was a vaccine available. And then for marketing reasons, they had to change the image of these diseases to make them something terrible and awful to be feared.
Now it seems like it's a life-threatening epidemic to get it.
Right. It's not a life-threatening epidemic to get any of these diseases that they don't have a vaccine for. But the ones they have a vaccine for, they suddenly become life-threatening because there's a vaccine. We need to understand that vaccine policy and law is driven by mainstream medicine. And mainstream medicine, for whatever good that it does and includes and has, is also severely and substantially corrupt. And it's corrupt in the sense that it has been skewed by the pharmaceutical industry's influence over state and federal legislatures and health departments to skew policy and law to favor them from a marketing point of view. Because not only are vaccines now a multi-billion dollar industry, and again, no liability, virtually no liability for all practical purposes, but vaccines are introducing chronic disease into the population, and everyone who develops a chronic disease from a vaccine and it doesn't kill them, then is potentially a lifelong customer for other pharmaceutical products.
You're listening to vaccine exemption attorney Ellen Phillips, interviewed by Tony Rango. Today's show, Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
we need to understand that psychopaths make up a certain percentage of the population. I've seen different figures ranging from 4 to 8%. And every psychopath is not a serial killer. Some of these people are intellectually brilliant, and they learn at a very early age how to act appropriately, even though they have no conscience themselves. They can see and imitate and learn how to act. And some of these people will rise up the corporate ladder or the government ladder to key decision-making positions, and in fact have done so. So the evidence of this is not simply conspiracy theory. There's objective evidence for this. The pharmaceutical industry routinely engages as just a matter of business practice in massive criminal behavior. There have been combined criminal civil fines, $100 million and up, as high as $3 billion or more, at least 33, 34 times since 2001. That's just the ones above 100 million. You know, I don't have the time to go researching all the ones that were only in the millions or hundreds, thousands or whatever. And criminal fines have been in the hundreds of millions of dollars and even as high as $1 billion, the criminal portion of these larger combined criminal civil fines. This is an industry that routinely engages in massive criminal behavior, as documented. Anybody can go to the Justice Department website and look it up. It's right there for anybody to go see who wants to take the time to do that. So the question is, why do they do that? Well, for three simple reasons. One, nobody goes to jail. There's nobody that's held accountable in the way that people are ordinarily held accountable in our society for criminal behavior. Two, there's a net profit. They wouldn't do this unless there was a net profit. And the behavior has gotten worse. If you look at the size and frequency and number of these fines, they have gotten larger and larger over the last several years compared to prior years. So the problem's getting worse and worse. And they wouldn't do it unless there was a net profit. So there's a net profit. And then again, the third reason, because the people who are making these decisions, and I'm not rendering a diagnosis here, I'm using labels to make a point. They're either sociopaths or psychopaths. And what I mean by that is they lack a conscience. They lack the ability to refrain from engaging in behavior, even though it's profitable, because it's going to cause some unnecessary death and disability. But when you make those kinds of decisions in the healthcare arena, well, at least the way the legal system is set up right now, these people, they pay fines when they get caught. Who knows how many times they do things and don't get caught. But when they get caught, yes, they'll pay fines, and sometimes some pretty heavy fines. I'm not suggesting that in 2012, for example, when GlaxoSmithKline paid a $3 billion fine, $1 billion criminal, $2 billion civil, I'm not suggesting they were happy. But there is this, to use a quick analogy, a little skit on the Laugh-In show two or three decades ago. The old lady comes into the pharmacy and she asks for her prescription, and the pharmacist says, that'll be $5. You can tell how long ago it was now, right? He says, that'll be $5. And then the phone rings and he picks up the phone and starts talking. Well, the little old lady pulls out two quarters and waves in front of the guy, but he's busy on the phone, doesn't see her. She sets the two quarters down on the counter and walks out. The pharmacist gets off the phone, looks down and sees 50 cents, and he says, he yells out to the lady, no, lady, that wasn't 50 cents, it's $5, but she's already gone. And then the punchline is, oh, well, quarter profit's better than none. So, you know, it's like, who cares if you pay a $3 billion fine if there's a $20 billion profit? And the World Health Organization back in 2009 estimated that developed nations individually, this is not collectively, individually, on average probably have about $23 billion of corrupt healthcare practice going on. And I saw an estimate, more recent estimate, talking about the U.S. specifically estimating something more in the range of $60 billion. In 2014, or at the end of 2014, the Justice Department bragged that during 2014, they had recovered $3.3 billion. And let's give credit where credit is due. That's a lot of money to get back from the pharmaceutical industry. But if they're doing $23 billion or maybe $60 billion, depending on, you know, whose estimate you look at, that's one heck of a net profit. So the industry certainly doesn't want to pay fines if they can get away with it. But when you got that kind of a net profit, the only thing that's going to stop somebody at that point is if they have a conscience and realize that, hey, it's not okay to engage in behavior that creates unnecessary death and disability, or is even just morally or ethically wrong. So we need to understand that there are people in key decision-making positions who will make decisions that hurt, injure, and kill people, so long as there's a net profit and they are not being directly held accountable for it. There are people who will do that. There are people who have been doing it and are doing it as we speak. And once we get over this hump of, well, nobody would really do that, then we can get to a place where we can really look at the problem and start to take some steps to address it.
Right. And you mentioned this accountability, quote unquote, for the pharmaceuticals, but this is somewhat accountability because those companies are setting that money aside and the shareholders are paying. So there is not really accountability, but that doesn't even exist with vaccines. You and I are paying that with our taxpayer funds that go into the system. Isn't that correct?
Well, the way they have it structured and labeled, it's a tax that the manufacturer pays, 75 cents on every vaccine. But do you think they take that out of their profit, or do you think they just add it on to the cost of the vaccine? So, you know, whether you want to say they pay for it or we pay for it sort of depends on how you want to look at it. And then, you know, who buys the vaccines? You and I do. So we're paying that tax in the cost of vaccines, whether it's the government. State and federal governments, of course, purchase vaccines and administer vaccines, but, you know, private citizens do as well. So it's some combination. But any way you want to look at it, it's not like they're, you know, taking that out of their bottom line and just, you know, taking a hit for the common good. That's not the way this works. So yeah, at the end of the day, it's the taxpayers who are paying this net money. The tax that on each vaccine, it goes into a federal government fund that then is where the money comes from to compensate through the Vaccine Energy Compensation Program victims of vaccines or their families.
Which, when there is criminal or quasi-criminal behavior, that is not impacting the actual manufacturers of the vaccines or the doctors themselves that are administering it.
Well, part of this 1986 Act requires vaccine manufacturers to take steps to make safer vaccines, but there's no enforcement mechanism. They're in this program, happy to have the program that significantly removed liability when the act was passed in 1986. But then we had a 2011 U.S. Supreme Court case that took it even further. That basically said there's virtually no liability now. And originally, the law said you have to go to this federal program first. And if you don't like the results of that, then you can go to state court and sue just like you would any other personal injury case. But the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted the language in the law in such a way as to say, no, you really can't do that anymore. Again, for all practical purposes, it is the first and last stop now. And, you know, I said earlier, doctors are required to give information to vaccine recipients or their parents informing people of this program. Well, they're not doing that. And there are today roughly 140, 150 attorneys around the country who do these vaccine injury compensation cases. And by the way, for all people listening to this, there is no cost to hire one of these attorneys. The government pays the attorneys on both sides in these cases. And there are people representing themselves because they can't afford an attorney and they don't realize you don't have to afford an attorney. So you always want to have an attorney whenever you can with any important legal matter, because unfortunately the legal system is complex. And there are a lot of people with winning cases who lose because they don't know how to navigate the legal system. And unfortunately, it's a complex system, and it really helps to have an expert guide you through that system or represent you through the system, especially with vaccine injury compensation.
Well, let's go back to the corruption in science. I want to talk a little bit more about that. And what other ways has science and research been corrupted? And maybe tell us a little about Dr. Thompson and what he has revealed.
Well, let me back up a step on a couple of points here. I want to talk about just a little bit about the medical publishing industry, because what doctors rely on, very few doctors have time, and medical students even less time, to actually go out and do medical research on vaccines or anything else for that matter. And when they can find time to read the medical journals, they'll look at the conclusions, and that's what they base their practice in large part on. Or the CDC or other governmental, non-governmental agencies will often look to the medical literature, and that can drive to a large extent what goes on. Now, the point I'm about to get to is separate and apart from the idea of cherry picking, which goes on considerably, where you look at the studies that say what you want them to say and you ignore the studies that don't say what you want them to say. Somehow those studies are either non-existent or they're wrong by default, because if you have a preconceived conclusion rather than looking objectively to see whether or not there's consensus in the medical literature, and if so, what it is, and if there's not consensus, what are the conflicting points and why, and so forth. Doctors don't have the time to get into that. So a couple of comments here from three different people who are either in or have been in the heart of the mainstream medical publishing world. And the first quote here comes from Dr. Marcia Angel from Harvard University. And she was an editor for the New England Journal of Medicine for 20 years. And she went public, I think it was back in 2004. It's been several years ago now. She said it's simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians and authoritative medical guidelines. And she was very reluctant to say this. She says, I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reached slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. And she wrote a book called The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It. It comes from somebody who's as much a mainstream insider as you could be. Or certainly she was. Another quote here. This comes from a gentleman by the name of John Ioannidis. And he wrote something in 2005, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. And he says in the abstract of this article, simulations show that for most study designs and settings, it's more likely for a research claim to be false than true. And that for many current scientific fields, research findings may simply be accurate measures of the prevailing bias. Going to the comment I was saying there, that there seems to be a tendency to, when you want to assert a point of view, you cherry pick. Now, you know, what did Dr. Angel say in articles I've read about hers and probably gets into in depth in her book? And in one sense, it's sort of simple. It's just that money is driving what gets published and what the published research says rather than objective science. You publish a study and it either supports or doesn't support a new drug, and millions, if not $1 billion or more, can be on the line there. And there's just something about money when it reaches a certain level that it takes on a life of its own and it rolls over anything in its path. And whether it's because people have a phenomenally myopic vision and can't or refuse to see the moral and ethical issues and lines, and even outright civil and criminal legal lines, or because they just deliberately choose to roll over it anyway, who knows in any given situation. But that is, in fact, what's happening, is that these lines are being rolled over. And more recently, just last year, the same fellow, Dr. Ioannidis, says, currently many published research findings are false or exaggerated, and an estimated 85% of research resources are wasted. And I would add wasted maybe with respect to objective science, but probably otherwise very carefully targeted to sell products.
You're listening to vaccine exemption attorney Alan Phillips, interviewed by Tony Rango. Today's show, Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
I want to take it one step further, because this comes from earlier this year. Richard Horton, who is the editor-in-chief of The Lancet. This is one of the most respected and prestigious medical journals on the planet, as is the New England Journal of Medicine that Marcia Angel used to work for as well. But here's Richard Horton, editor-in-chief of The Lancet. He says, the case against science is straightforward. Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue. He gives a quick list of some of the reasons for this, but the end phrase here is very telling, Tony. He says, science has taken a turn towards darkness. Now, this is not the kind of language that somebody who's the editor-in-chief of a prestigious medical journal uses. Science has taken a turn toward darkness. That's just not, you know, that's not a scientific phrase or even an intellectual kind of phrase. To me, this is a cry for help. Science has taken a turn towards darkness. He sees something that is totally out of control and just doesn't have any other way to phrase it. This is my interpretation, but I can't come up with any other explanation for this, that phrase, science has taken a turn towards darkness. That's a cry for help. But some of it gets just downright absurd. There was a Harvard science journalist who submitted 304 versions of a fraudulent research paper to open access journals, and more than half of the journals accepted the paper for publication. You know, what kind of a world do we live in when you can make up a study and somebody will publish it? But it gets even more absurd. I'm going to take it one step further. This is from an article in MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT News, in April of this year, 2015, how three MIT students fooled the world of scientific journals. These three students wrote a computer program that they called SciGen, S-C-I-G-E-N, SciGen. This computer program generates random computer science papers, complete with realistic-looking graphs and figures and citations, but it's just random. It invents made-up science papers, and they've actually had these papers be accepted. One paper was accepted for a presentation in a conference. And there was a situation a couple of years ago where the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers and Springer Publishing, they removed more than 120 papers from their websites after a French researcher's analysis determined that more than 120 papers were generated by SciGen, a computer science program that was written just as a joke. Now, they had to be really good. These must have been really convincing-looking fake studies, you know, to be accepted. But how could anybody read a fake study and then not recognize that it's a fake study, you know, randomly generated? So this is the point here. We're at a place where scientific publishing is a joke. And I'm sorry to say that, because I'm sure there are many credible researchers with high integrity who do serious work, submit for publishing, and get published. So I'm not saying that that doesn't ever happen. But what is also happening is that you can just make up studies, and a lot of times they'll still get published. Or you can even have a computer program invent random arbitrary studies and they get published. This is a very sad state of affairs that we're in. And all this comes back to a real simple but profound point. We want to bring it back into vaccines specifically and medical publishing. If the medical literature is not reliable, and clearly based on what I've just said, it's not, then who should have the final decision making for you and your kids, and when it comes to healthcare issues, you or the state or your employer or anybody who's going to rely on this fraudulent research that's out there, or potentially fraudulent research, unreliable research?
I heard about those different studies and things you mentioned, and it's truly amazing, and I think darkness captures it quite well.
Right. Well, This sort of leads into another question here. You know, the vaccine policy and law, in fact, healthcare policy and law generally, is driven by mainstream medicine. So this gets into the question of, you know, why did we fail with SB 277 and another bill in Illinois that passed that is the most egregious religious exemption law I've ever seen in the country now in Illinois. And we had some, you know, wonderful successes in other parts of the country, but, you know, they're going to come back better organized and better strategies. And, you know, we've got our work cut out for us here. But there's a real important distinction, especially with respect to talking with legislators, trying to educate them on the issue, in my opinion. And the distinction has to do with the difference between what has been officially documented and what hasn't. What I'm saying for purposes of educating legislators, your better starting points are the already confirmed, officially, formally documented things, such as the fines that have been assessed and paid, for example. You know, you show a legislator, and I've started putting some of this information in graphs so you can look at it and see it as a picture, and it just, you know, the old saying, a picture speaks a thousand words, or whatever it is, really can hold true for some of these vaccine issues. You look at a graph, and I've put one of these together just in the last few days, of the payouts year to year from the vaccine compensation program, and there's all these tall bars on the right side of the graph, because in the last 6 years, the payout amounts have skyrocketed compared to all the prior years. The average in the last 6 years, over twice the average across the duration of the whole program. You look at a graph of the criminal and civil fines in the pharmaceutical industry that are above $100 million over the last, say, 15 years, and you see in the last several years, 6, 7, 8 years, you see these bars on the right side that are way taller than all the bars on the left side, and you see that the combined criminal fines are in the multi-billions of dollars over in the last several years, whereas they were only in the hundreds of millions of dollars in preceding years. So, you know, sometimes a graph just really communicates better than, you know, giving a study or writing a paragraph or whatever.
You've also been working with a lot of healthcare workers as well over the past number of years, certainly as the pressure's been increasing. What kind of success have you been having with exemptions and getting them support with their jobs?
Well, based on what my clients have been telling me, and I've heard this from at least three different clients, where different parts of the country, where they say our hospital system has had over 1,000 requests for exemptions, or over 1,500 in one instance. The hospital administrators brag that they only allowed, you know, 4 exemptions in one case, or very few or no exemptions. So they offer exemptions, but they don't really want to grant any. What I see in my practice is that the vast majority of my healthcare worker clients will get the exemptions, high 90s. I haven't kept track of it specifically, you know, and documented, but the vast majority of them do. When people don't get an exemption, if they have come to me up front and they're working with me up front, as opposed to trying it on their own and then they get rejected, because a lot of times people have unwittingly, of course, shot themselves in the foot, and it can be really more difficult in those situations. But the people who come to me up front from the start will almost always, if not always, end up with a qualifying exemption. The question then becomes, does the employer cooperate or not? And the problem with any vaccine exemption arena is that the people on the other side have the leverage. If they want to make you jump through hoops to enforce your rights, they can do that. And so the question then becomes, when that happens, how far is my client willing to go? So the few instances where I've had clients who didn't get an exemption, it's usually because they stopped fighting at some point, even though they had a winning position. They didn't want to pay me, or didn't have money to pay me to take it to the next step. Or they go to the EEOC, for example, which is where you go if you have a dispute with an employer about a religious exemption, and you want to take it to the next step formally. Maybe if the EEOC doesn't get it right, you can go to court then, but people don't have the money or the emotional stamina or whatever it is to go to court. So I've had clients with winning cases that just stopped at some point for whatever reason. But again, the vast majority of them in this arena are successful. And my impression is, from my clients tell me, is that the vast majority who aren't getting legal help are not successful. And because people on both sides of the issue don't understand how it works legally.
Right. So you're able to help these folks more with the federal religious exemption rather than working with families, say, in California, who are dealing with state exemption issues. Is that correct?
Well, I work with clients and, when necessary, local attorneys around the country. And whether it's state law or federal law or a mixture, just depends on, you know, the specific situation. There's a long list of different categories where exemption issues come up, and most people don't realize. I didn't realize it when I first got into this work how vast, broad, and deep it is. But vaccines are required at birth, for school and daycare enrollment, for college enrollment, increasingly at work, in the military, and that can involve military members, families, and civilian contractors, for immigrants, which could include foreign adopted children. Another issue I see coming up more and more in my practice is where parents divorce or split up and disagree about whether or not to vaccinate the kids, and the legal arguments there are completely different from other child custody disputes, and family law attorneys just don't see that. And I've spoken now with dozens of family law attorneys around the country, and I've never talked to one who knew what I had to share with them before we got on the phone and talked about it. It's not because I'm smarter than any of them, but I've just been focused on this issue for years and years, and you know, they're seeing it for the first time when it comes up there. So just a lot of different arenas where vaccines are required, and you've got to understand what law applies and how it applies and what the exemptions are. And, you know, in terms of exemptions for school and daycare, for example, it varies from state to state because the federal government doesn't have authority to mandate vaccines for state residents. But with employers and employees, there are only three states that have state exemption laws that would apply to any healthcare workers or employees. So most states don't have a state law at all that can help them in that arena, but federal civil rights law can help them. And it's not about a vaccine religious exemption per se. It's about religious discrimination in the workplace. But the law can function for practical purposes like a vaccine religious exemption. So you just have to understand what situation you're in, what the starting place is in terms of the law. And often it's a mixture of state and federal law, because anytime, for example, there's a religious exemption that brings in federal constitutional free exercise of religion rights and so forth.
You're listening to vaccine exemption attorney Alan Phillips, interviewed by Tony Rango. Today's show, Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Let's switch gears a little bit and go back to California. I wanted to get on the SB 277. You said you had some advice for parents regarding that as far as an approach goes, either for other states or for parents in California. What's your thoughts?
Well, first of all, just the obligatory disclaimer, I'm not offering legal advice on the air here. I'm just offering information for general educational purposes. But I would point out that the language in SB 277 refers to a letter or affidavit that if you get into the daycare or school before January 1st, 2016, then you can preserve your right to continue exercising the personal belief exemption under the old law until the child reaches either kindergarten or seventh grade. So people whose child is going into kindergarten or seventh grade next fall, I think are out of luck unless they're going to homeschool or leave the state, frankly. But a lot of people are saying, make sure you have a personal belief exemption in to preserve your right under the old law. And I'm not asserting one way or the other. I'm just raising a question. I don't know whether a personal belief exemption falls under this label of letter or affidavit. So if it were me and I lived in California, I would write a letter and I would get it notarized, which is what makes a document an affidavit, or I would label it affidavit. I would make sure that I had a letter or affidavit is what I'm saying. It may be that the personal belief form under the old law counts as a letter or affidavit, but I'm not sure if it does. So I'm just raising that question. But there's an aspect of this new law, Tony, that is really fascinating, and that's that it rewrites the medical exemption, and it's incredibly broad. It really puts the total authority in the hands of medical doctors, and without restricting them by saying you have to meet this condition or this criteria in a specific way. It's very general language, which leaves it pretty wide open for doctors to exercise their professional discretion, and that's the end of the story. So I don't know whether doctors who write medical exemptions are going to be you know, there can be some consequence for that politically or, you know, some kind of pressure. But the language of the law gives the doctor pretty much total authority to decide.
Yeah, and that raises actually a question I had. Have you heard of doctors getting punished for not sticking to certain vaccination schedules or getting an incentive to have a higher vaccination rate or compliance rate? Is there any kind of incentive or coercion techniques?
When you have these enormous financial interests and people who are able and willing to do anything to protect those interests and further those interests, you know, you risk some negative feedback when you start messing with those interests. And the vaccine industry, it was really interesting that somebody else had to sort of bring this to my attention. The Vaccine Injury Compensation Program in that 1986 law substantially removes liability for manufacturers or anyone administering vaccines for the death and disability that's caused by vaccines. But your vaccine has to be on the list. So the industry has been making this aggressive shift away from whatever else they do and into the vaccine arena where they have limited liability. And so there are all kinds of things now, treatments that are being developed, they're being called vaccines that have nothing to do with childhood infectious diseases. There are vaccines under development for obesity, for cocaine addiction, you know, for things you would never think of as having to do with the vaccine. And if it has anything to do with the immune system, I guess they can call it a vaccine. And then if they can get it on the vaccine list, they'll have no liability for it. And, you know, the patents on a lot of the blockbuster drugs have recently run out or are running out. And so they're looking for another basket to put their eggs in. And they're putting it in the vaccine basket. So the push for flu vaccines is just a door opener. The CDC has been saying for years already that they want to revaccinate every adult with all the childhood vaccines. But there are literally hundreds of new vaccines in development. I heard a figure over 270 vaccines, and this was several months ago now, that were already at the FDA waiting for approval or licensure. Vaccines have to be licensed by the FDA before they can be administered in the U.S., or they were in clinical trials the last stages before going to the FDA. So there's just this enormous shift into the vaccine arena and away from other places where the profits are not as big and the liability is still there. So this is a disturbing progression, because we're going to see more and more kinds of vaccines developed or things called vaccines that you would never think of as having anything to do with vaccines, so that they can get into this no liability arena. And every man, woman, and child on the planet is a potential recipient of vaccines from the moment of birth until somewhere up to, what, a year after you die, you're supposed to keep getting flu shots now, I think. You know, I mean, it might as well be. It's as ridiculous as all this is, and there's just no limit to the number of vaccines, as far as the industry is concerned, that any person can get at any stage and age in their life. And the reason they're requiring healthcare workers to get flu vaccines is the healthcare workers are the door opener to the rest of the adult population. We're supposed to all look at the healthcare workers and say, oh, they're the health professionals, they're all getting flu shots, it must be good, I better go get my flu shot. And, of course, they'll conveniently leave out the part that the reason that they're getting these shots is because they'd lose their jobs if they didn't. And then the flu vaccine, a door opener to literally hundreds of new vaccines to come. So it's an open-ended agenda. There's no light at the end of this tunnel.
Right. And you mentioned getting vaccinations at birth. And my understanding, I think I heard you talk about this at one point, is why they're given at birth and at such a young age, because you have such an underdeveloped immune system until you're about 1 year old. So why would you actually need a vaccine when you're that young?
Well, I saw a doctor at a formal presentation several years ago say that children shouldn't be vaccinated at all until they're about 4 or 5 because of the development and maturation of the immune system. So there are different opinions out there about who should get how many vaccines and when, if any. And my position, my professional public position, is everybody should have the right to make that decision for themselves and their children in consultation with the healthcare professional of their choosing, whether it's allopathic or otherwise. Because as soon as you put that decision in the hands of the state where you're being required to, then the doors open for industry to influence to its benefit and to our detriment that decision, which is exactly what's going on in the world here. But the Hep B vaccines, when you say why are they doing it, it depends on what perspective. I mean, one answer to that question is because they can get away with it and make lots of money for it. You know, hepatitis B is not a high-risk disease for newborns. I can count on one hand the number of newborn children I've ever heard of anywhere who were sexually promiscuous intravenous drug users. You know, it's just a really small percentage. I think really, you know, right down there at or next to zero, I would guess. I'm being facetious here, but the point is to show you how stupid, it's incredibly stupid this is. And I remember somebody telling me they had asked a nurse once, well, why do we vaccinate newborns? And the answer was something like, because that's what we do. You know, that's the mentality that's out there with a lot of people. They just follow orders. You do what you're told. They don't want to make waves because they don't want to lose their job or be disciplined or be scolded or yelled at by, you know, the supervising doctor or whatever. So people are just all following orders. Well, that's what happened in Nazi Germany, okay? And you see the results there. So there's a huge profit there. But the medical reason that they give is, well, this was the only vaccine that at least some newborns would actually have an immune response to. They of course, have tried to give all the other vaccines at birth, but there's no immune response. So they wait till 2 months and 4 months and 6 months and 12 and 15 months and whatever it is they do with which vaccines. Supposedly, it's based on when they can get immune response in the infant or toddler or wherever it is. So that's the argument. But why, you know, that's why hepatitis B and no other vaccines. But why would you vaccinate for hepatitis B at all? The only risk is if a child's mother has hepatitis B, and you can test the mother ahead of time and find out. You don't need to risk injury or death from the vaccine by vaccinating every newborn just in case mom has hepatitis B. No, you test mom. And a vaccine's not going to help you anyway. This is the same story. You go into the emergency room with a deep cut or puncture wound and they want to give you a tetanus shot. It's not going to help you. If you're exposed to hepatitis B at birth, a hepatitis B vaccine is not going to help you. Vaccines take days or weeks to develop a full antibody response. And if you're exposed to tetanus by the cut, the tetanus vaccine isn't going to help you. What you need are tetanus antibodies. Maybe that would help you. But I'll tell you, when I talked about this with Dr. Mayor Eisenstein, he said, well, they used to do that, but they stopped doing that because they used to give the tetanus antibodies in the emergency room, but they stopped doing it because the reactions were so severe. So they said, well, we'll just give the vaccine. So it becomes, the whole thing is medically ridiculous. It serves a non-medical agenda, and most people are just going to follow orders and not question anything and not look into it for themselves. We got to get over that. The shift that is taking place, Tony, and that we need to facilitate with shows like this and other things that we can do, is a shift from external reliance to internal reliance, where we just turn over all the important decision maker to other people and just blindly follow whatever they say. Because whenever you do that, you open the door to manipulation and control. And that's exactly what's happened. Now, I'm not saying you don't look outside of yourself to get information, but at the end of the day, you take responsibility for deciding what's best for you and for your children, and we work to get laws in place that allow us to do that. Because while ultimately this is a scientific issue, are vaccines safe? Are they effective? Are they necessary? Are there other things we can do? That's all science questions. The way it plays out in our lives day to day is a legal question. At any given point in time, when somebody's required to get a vaccine, there's either a law that says you can say no or there isn't. So where the rubber meets the road primarily is in the state legislature. So we've got to become legislatively involved, whether we like that or not. And we've got to be proactive, pushing our agenda for informed choice, because whether we do that or not, they're pushing their agenda backed by huge sums of money and lobbyists and so forth. So if we don't become proactive, we lose. It's not a question of if, it's just a question of when. So that's where we need to get involved here.
Right, and you mentioned getting legislatively active, and I would point listeners to check out the National Vaccine Information Center, nvic.org, I believe it is, and go there, and you can get information about the states and what's happening in your own state, and also get on their list and get active so that you can get involved with what's happening locally in your own area in your state.
Yeah, I strongly recommend them. They have what they call their advocacy portal. They actually have a separate web address for that. You can get there from nvic.org, or you can go there directly from nvicadvocacy.org, and that's the advocacy portal. And they have really streamlined the process. You no longer have to take time off and make it a part-time job to be legislatively active. You can go to this website and sign up. And if you choose to join and give them your mailing address information, the software will tell you who your representatives are and what their phone numbers and addresses are. And they keep that information confidential, of course, so only they and the NSA have access to it. So it's a feeble attempt at humor there. Unfortunately, it's probably true. But the point is this. They've made it as easy as possible to be legislatively active and involved.
Excellent. Well, Alan Phillips, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. It's been a pleasure.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You've been listening to Alan Phillips, interviewed by Tony Rango. Today's show has been Vaccines, Threads of Corruption. Alan Phillips is a practicing attorney headquartered in North Carolina. He is a nationally recognized legal expert on vaccine policy and law, whose practice is focused solely on vaccine exemptions and waivers and vaccine legislative activism. He advises individuals, families, attorneys, legislators, and legislative activists throughout the U.S. on vaccine exemption and waiver rights and vaccine politics and law. He hosts a weekly radio show, The Vaccine Agenda, every Monday evening, available at blogtalkradio.com/The Vaccine Agenda. He is the author of The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, published as an ebook. Visit his website at vaccinerights.com. He may be contacted at attorney@vaccinerights.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yarrow Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Which is the evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
This is Kenneth Doust. The show you're about to hear is a rerun from about 4 years ago. So, when I talk about the scoundrels seeking the presidential nominations, just swap a name or two. When I say Herman Cain, just think Ben Carson. How hard could that be? Enjoy! From Darkest Connecticut, welcome to New World Notes, hosted yet again by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. The title of today's installment is Trends. If you care about the latest fashions, about which celebs are hot and which are not, what's in and what's out, if you care about being in on the latest buzz, or better yet, the cause of the latest buzz, if you want to be among those setting the trends, not just playing catch-up, if this is you I'm describing, then of course you're probably not listening to this show, you're doing something else. Probably reading Vanity Fair magazine, or worse, the feature section of your local newspaper. Good riddance. And don't tune in next week either. Bold colors are the latest look in ladies' trousers this season? Drop dead. Okay, generally, New World Notes is not concerned with the latest, hottest trends in anything. Which is one reason we've said not a word about the Republican presidential candidate beauty pageant that's been going on for about a year already. Try to even remember all those once hot names. Can Rick Goodhair Perry maintain his lead over the brown bomber Herman Cain? Can Michelle Bachmann step into Sarah Palin's $1,200 shoes? Who's hotter this week, Donald Trump or Professor Newton Gingrich? Please. As you're leaving the circus, do you care which clown was which? As I'm composing these words in early April, the Republican beauty pageant is still underway. Here is New World Notes' fearless prediction of who will come out on top of the Republican candidate contest. The guy who's a committed imperialist, who will continue bankrupting the country with ever-increasing military expenditures for aggressive wars all over the earth. The guy who will ignore both climate change and energy depletion, who will further reduce taxes on the rich and on corporations, while selling off all public services as rapidly as possible to for-profit businesses. Who will further destroy what remains of constitutional liberties, democracy, and the prosperity of the 99%. That's the Republican nominee. Who will the Democrats nominate? Why, the same guy, of course. Here's an update. After I composed those words, it now looks like one particular person is clearly destined for the Republican nomination, and one for the Democratic, and I correctly picked both candidates. Sheer genius on my part. But seriously, folks, enough gloom and doom, and back to today's hottest trends. We'll have a wide-ranging and quirky show today, yes again. We'll look at trends in housing and suburban design. We'll look at Botox for men. We'll have some whimsy from satirists Paul Krassner and George Carlin, music by David Rovix, and more. I hope you'll stay tuned. Let's start with a new trend I've spotted, getting great wealth and using it to further oppress everyone else. You heard it here first. There's a cute series of character profiles on the web called How the 1% Exploits America. Here's the one on Pete Peterson.
Who's getting rich exploiting the 99%? Meet the worst of the 1%. Pete Peterson, co-founder of the Blackstone Group. Wealth, $2 billion. Pete Peterson made his fortune doing corporate takeovers, resulting in layoffs, and is now spending $1 billion on a campaign to slash Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Peterson is allocating this money to an echo chamber of think tanks and advocates, giving the Americans the false impression that Social Security will soon be insolvent. In fact, the program has accrued a $3 trillion surplus expected to last for at least 30 years.
Pete Peterson, trendsetter to watch. He'll be bigger than Lady Gaga someday. As Dad used to say, in his Boston accent, mock my words. Hey, for the past 2 weeks, we've been listening to a radio adaptation of an interesting Canadian documentary film called The End of Suburbia. It's about the end of cheap, plentiful oil and cheap, plentiful natural gas, and hence cheap, plentiful electricity. And it's about the changes scarcer, expensive energy will require in our civilization. I use the term civilization loosely. The film was made 8 years ago, and you can see that its predictions for the near term were pretty much spot on. It predicted constant warfare to control oil and natural gas resources. It predicted growing popular discontent and popular protest against the constant wars and occupations. The film predicted increasing government destruction of civil liberties and government crackdown on dissent. And it predicted a decrease in suburban living, indeed the end of suburbia. Pretty good trend spotting, eh? Its prediction about energy wars, popular dissent, crackdowns on popular dissent, and destruction of civil liberties have already proven correct. And it looks like the fourth one is starting to come true, the end of suburbia. But let's be clear about what we mean. The classic suburb is a large bunch of houses, nothing or hardly anything but houses, built on farmland, roughly built all at once, built many miles from the city where all the jobs are. A development reachable these days only by car. I think most of us don't live in a suburb of that classic sort. Here in southern New England, that sort of suburban bedroom development is actually rare. Most people live in towns, towns that became towns a couple hundred years back. All my life, in three different parts of the country, I've lived in a city or I've lived in a town. But let's not get complacent. Our towns are becoming much more like suburbs. The towns are less and less self-sufficient. They have fewer and fewer places to work, fewer and fewer places to shop, very bad or no public transportation, fewer and fewer places to walk to, fewer and fewer places that a sane person could bicycle to. The shops on Main Street are closing one after another. Want to buy something? Hop into your minivan and drive to the mall area at the town's far limits. So this kind of suburb is not just a square mile of little boxes, all built of ticky-tacky, 50 miles east of L.A., that's going to get its butt kicked when highway construction stops and gasoline hits $20 a gallon, and it costs $1,200 a month to heat your three-bedroom suburban ranch house, to say nothing of your brother-in-law's McMansion. So not just in the classic hardcore suburbs, but in fact, I think the vast majority of us are going to be in deep doo-doo in the near future. Speaking of McMansions, what's going to happen to these structures that are going to be too expensive to drive to, too expensive to heat in the winter, too expensive to air condition in the summer, and now worth $100,000 less than the owner paid for it? Here's a prediction by urban designers Peter Calthorpe and James Howard Kunstler.
First-ring suburbs are already becoming the ghettos. They don't have the underlying beauty and structure of our historic cities and towns to kind of rebuild on. So they become quite a challenging situation. But I don't think that's something that might happen. It's something that is happening.
the suburbs that were really built after the 1960s, the ones that are really past the inner rings, are going to become pretty deeply dysfunctional. We may see, you know, more than one family living in a McMansion, and we may see them growing crops on what used to be the front lawn. But I think that they'll basically be the slums of the future.
8 years after those predictions, hot off the press, here's news of what's hot in real estate. It's by AP writer Hope Yen, and it's headlined, U.S. Growth of Distant Suburbs Falls to Historic Low. Washington, stunned by high gasoline costs, outlying suburbs that sprouted in the heady 2000s are now seeing their growth fizzle to historic lows, halting American city dwellers' decades-long exodus to sprawling homes in distant towns. New census estimates as of July 2011 highlight a shift in population trends following an extended housing bust and renewed spike in oil prices. 2 years after the recession technically ended, and despite faint signs of a rebound, Americans are shunning moves at record levels and staying put in big cities. This is posing longer-term consequences for residential exurbs, so-called, on the edge of metropolitan areas. Construction of gleaming new schools and mega malls built in anticipation of a continued population boom is being cut back. Spacious McMansions offering the promise of home ownership to middle-class families sit abandoned or half-built. Once an escape from urban problems, suburban regions hit by foreclosures are posting bigger jumps in poverty than cities. The result? The annual rate of growth in American cities and surrounding urban areas has now surpassed that of exurbs for the first time in at least 20 years, spanning the modern era of sprawling suburban development. The heyday of exurbs may well be behind us, says Yale University economist Robert J. Shiller. Suburban housing prices may not recover in our lifetime, Shiller said, calling the development of suburbs since 1950 unusual and enabled only by the rise of the automobile and the nation's highway system. The signs of longer-term bust are evident in places such as Kendall County, Illinois, an outlying suburb of 116,000 people located about 50 miles southwest of Chicago. This was the nation's number one fastest-growing county from 2000 to 2010. Kendall was part of an ex-urban wave that more than doubled its population. By the late 2000s, however, Kendall County's growth began to wane amid recession and rising gasoline costs. By 2011, its annual growth had slowed to 1%, dropping its county growth rate rank to 236th. So the prediction that sprawling suburbs are not going to be economically viable seems to be now not just a prediction, but a trend that's starting to come to pass.
Were you drinking wine from Argentina or Indonesian coffee? Did you take some in a plane and go fly across the country? Did you go to work the next week, drive your daily 20 miles? Stop at Sears to see the latest Chinese styles. When you did these things, did you wonder how or why? In the years before the oil wells ran dry. Were you watching the news? Did you wonder when they'd bomb another country or start up the draft again as you tried to stop the war that might decide the planet's fate? Did you stop to question how that food got on your plate as you stuck your fork into that slice of pie in the years before the oil wells ran dry? When you went back to college to get another PhD, or you went into the studio to record one more CD, did it occur to you that your time might be spent better digging in the earth or learning to knit a sweater? Did you prepare for all the changes or at least pretend to try? in the years before the oil wells ran dry. When the cars and planes stopped running, and the dollar hit the floor, and the hordes of hungry children were knocking on your door, when unemployed men in the streets said, blame the Arabs for our plight. Did you shot with dirt held high, farmers of the world unite? Did you ride an ox into town, say, join the Green Revolution or die? In the years before the oil wells ran dry.
David Rovix on our special trends show. Let's move on from real estate to beauty and fashion. First, here's a trend that I fearlessly predict will not catch on. It's from my local newspaper, March 15, and the non-starter trend it describes is inspecting power plants while naked. Hey, it's from David Rovix's hometown. Dateline, Norwalk. A superior judge has requested psychological treatment for a woman charged this week with walking naked inside a power plant with her two daughters. The culprit was arraigned Wednesday in Superior Court on charges of risk of injury to minors and trespassing. She was held in lieu of $20,000 bond. Police say the woman was found walking naked inside the Manresa power plant in Norwalk on the night of March 7, with her two daughters, aged 7 and 11. Police say the younger girl was naked and the older girl had only a shirt on. They say both girls were crying and shivering from being cold. Police said the girls are now with their father, who, needless to say, lives in New York. Okay, that trend probably is not going to fly. But catch trend number three. Here's another newspaper item, reprinted from that paragon of journalistic excellence, the Tampa Bay Times. Brotox trends as men become less skeptical. Yes, brothers and sisters, trends is now a verb. Brotox trends as men become less skeptical. I quote, they call it Brotox, slang for Botox treatment for guys. Evan Lobalbo had never heard of the word until his girlfriend suggested they do something to fight the mean signs of aging on their faces. I've popped zits that hurt more than that, he said after the treatment. It wasn't bad at all. Lobalbo is among a growing number of guys getting Botox injections and facial fillers to improve their looks. Men get Brotox, so-called, to look younger and gain confidence. They might be competing for a new job or trying to score a date. Too often, perhaps, people have told them that they look tired. Today's man is evolving, said Dr. Richard Castellano, who administers this treatment. Guys are feeling more comfortable with approving their appearance. They aren't as scared. Last year, more than 300,000 men got Botox, according to figures from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. That is a 10% increase from the previous year. Like their female counterparts, more men are starting treatments at a younger age. They prefer not to wait for visible signs of aging in their 50s and 60s. They want to prevent them. Lobalbo is 34, and he didn't like what he saw in the mirror. New lines on his forehead and around his eyes. But when his girlfriend Heather Knox recommended that they both try some cosmetic pick-me-ups, he refused. What would his friends think? What would he tell people? A little more prodding, and Lobalbo changed his mind. He wanted to support his 31-year-old girlfriend, and he figured he might like the results. About 2 weeks after the Botox and facial fillers, Lobalbo had no regrets. His girlfriend praised his smoother forehead. No one noticed a big change. A year after starting Botox, Scott Glass, 38, said the differences are subtle, but noticeable enough to come back every 6 months. I'm getting up there in age a little bit, he said. Unfortunately, lines come. I just want to look my best. Okay, another fine bit of journalism from the Tampa Bay Times, featuring a doctor who makes money giving Botox injections and two satisfied male customers who are in their 30s but already worried about no longer looking their best. So, another trend to make note of, if not necessarily to follow, Botox for guys. Now I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Ken, when it comes to spotting trends, you're the man. Not even Faith Popcorn could approach you as a trend spotter. But my local paper doesn't reprint stories from the Tampa Bay Times. What can I do to see what's trending? You ask. First, thank you for the kind words. Now here's some practical advice from the late George Carlin. You recall that Carlin was the genius who, years back, was the first to recognize one of the hottest new trends, homelessness. Now here's Carlin's advice on how to spot all the latest developing trends. Just go to the drugstore or supermarket and look at the magazine rack. If three or four people have started doing something, it'll have its own magazine. Look for new titles. Elbow Piercing Magazine. Best Buddhist Jokes. New England Cockroach Collector. Stuff like that. Let's hear it from the man himself, George Carlin.
We have to declare a war on everything. We have a war on crime, the war on poverty, the war on litter, the war on cancer, the war on drugs. But you ever notice we got no war on homelessness, huh? No war on homelessness. You know why? There's no money in that problem. No money to be made off of the homeless. If you could find a solution, if you could find a solution to homelessness where the corporate swine and the politicians could steal a couple of million dollars each, you'd see the streets of America begin to clear up pretty damn quick. I'll guarantee you that. I will guarantee you that. Yeah. I got an idea. You know what they ought to do? Give the homeless their own magazine. Give them their own magazine would make them feel better, for one thing. That's a sure sign of making it in this country. Every group in this country that arrives at a certain level has its own magazine. We have Working Mother Magazine, Black Entrepreneur Magazine, Hispanic Business Magazine. In fact, any activity engaged in by more than four people in this country has got a magazine devoted to it. Skydiving, snowmobiling, backpacking, mountain climbing, bungee jumping, skeet shooting, duck hunting, jerking off, playing pool, shooting someone in the hole with a dart gun. They probably got a magazine for that. Walking! For Christ's sakes, walking! There's actually a magazine called Walking. Look, Dan, the new Walking is out. Here's a good article, putting one foot in front of the other. Give them their own magazine. Give them their own magazine. You know what you call the magazine for the homeless? Better Crates and Cartons. Yeah, then when they get finished reading it, they can use it to line their clothing. That's a good sound business solution, isn't it? That's the kind of answer you get from a conservative American businessman in this country. Say, yeah, let them read it. When they get finished reading it, they can use it to plug up the holes in them piano crates they all seem to like to live in. A good sound, practical, conservative American business solution.
George Carlin, a funny guy and a very astute cultural analyst. He caught on to the war the 1% was waging against the 99% a decade or two before most of us finally noticed. Too bad he didn't live to see Occupy Wall Street. He would have been proud of us. I guess I'm using us a little loosely here, since my backside and the barricades never came into close proximity. I missed Woodstock, too, come to think of it. Speaking of hair, here's an emerging trend from this morning's paper. Natural hair color for women. According to this article, when American women turn 30, 40, 50, their hair starts turning gray, just like men's. Can you believe that? A former corporate executive, Anne Kramer, has written a book titled Going Gray. She's trying to start a trend here, and I say more power to her. But as an expert trend spotter, I'm forced to say, I don't think this one is going to fly, much as I'd like it to. Not in a culture where 30-year-old men are getting Botox injections so they don't look so old. Even Kramer warns women to be cautious in the cutthroat dog-eat-dog world of business. Employers like to fire older workers and replace them with younger ones, who will work longer hours for lower pay. So workers of both sexes, but especially women, engaged in doomed efforts to look younger than they are. Here's a sentence from the story that really stands out. In 1950, 7% of women dyed their hair, Kramer said. Today, it's closer to 95%, or more, depending on geographic location. 95%. After a century of modern feminism, after the Cultural Revolution of the late 60s, we end up here. As though one could not possibly be attractive naturally at age 60 or 50 or 40. The situation would be preposterous even if the treatment worked. But it doesn't work. A 50-year-old woman who dyes her hair does not look like a 25-year-old woman. She looks like a 50-year-old woman with fake hair. I am sorry, but somebody has to point this out. Clairol is not going to, nor is the Tampa Bay Times. The larger question is, what's wrong with looking 50 if you're 50? What's wrong with looking your age? Or acting it, for that matter? One last quote from today's paper. A trend that is catching on is green, eco-friendly, natural products for household cleaning. I'll just pass along one suggestion they make. Stop using harsh, toxic chemicals to clean that bathroom bowl. Instead, pour one can of Coke or Pepsi into your toilet bowl. Let sit 1 hour. This removes most stains, we are assured. I'll just add a final thought. If it does this great a job on porcelain, imagine how clean your insides will look if you drink a can. Well, we're running a little late, so I'll have to skimp on my rival trend spotter, Paul Krasner. But here are just a few items from his article called Save the Economy Tax Tweets, or Predictions for 2012. Vegetarian converts will include Lady Gaga, who will wear a dress made entirely of heirloom tomatoes. Howard Stern will expose himself on America's Got Talent. Square Hitler-style mustaches will finally become stylish after decades of ridicule. Botox will become a soft drink and will get rid of unwanted wrinkles from the inside. Pornography will be allowed in public libraries, but moaning out loud will definitely not be permitted. Arizona, Mississippi, and Tennessee will refuse to recognize leap year. And finally, the Department of Energy will release a report concluding that so-called clean coal is in fact filthy dirty. Thank you, Paul Krasner, and thank you, listener, for catching the trendiest installment ever of New World Notes. Check out our free archive and other neat stuff at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Your suggestions are appreciated, and you'll find my email address at the website. Once again, that's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum. Remember, gray is the new black. 30 is the new 50. A Botox a day and you'll live forever. And ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today we're going to take a look at the hoax of Islamic terrorism. From 9/11... the global war on terror, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Iraq and Syria, to San Bernardino and the corporate media. It's a big agenda, so let's begin. It all comes back to 9/11. 9/11 was the pivotal event that has fast-tracked the pre-planned agenda for full-spectrum dominance by the U.S. as laid out in the PNAC document, or the Project for a New American Century document, called Rebuilding America's Defenses, in which they state that Americans wouldn't buy into the military buildup that would be needed for them to implement their plans without a new Pearl Harbor. 9/11 was their pre-planned and orchestrated new Pearl Harbor, exploited to demonize Muslims and to preemptively and illegally attack Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Pakistan, and more, and their justification for taking away our civil liberties. I would encourage you to do a little research on the PNAC and see for yourself. There's a new 3-part film out about the PNAC called A Very Heavy Agenda by Robbie Martin. The 9/11 truth movement has documented so much evidence disproving the official story of 9/11 and exposing the government and media cover-up of the facts that if you still believe the government and controlled media's account of 9/11, which, by the way, is a conspiracy theory, you simply haven't been paying attention. If you're out of touch with what really happened 14 years ago on 9/11, then you're probably being taken in by the latest lies and deceptions. For the present situation in the Middle East and in our country to make sense, you really need to get it that what you've been told by the government and the media about 9/11 is a lie, and they continue to push those lies. Once you get that you've been lied to about 9/11, and I know that most of my listeners do get that, you'll also see that the global war on terror is a hoax, a deception, and a way to get you to support and finance our government's illegal and immoral military agenda. And now here's James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com on March 21st, 2010, talking about some of the more recent supposed domestic terrorist attacks.
Lawyers for 4 men indicted for allegedly planning to bomb a Jewish center in Riverdale, New York, have revealed that the entire scheme was concocted and planned by an FBI informant in the group. The defense in the case has filed a dismissal motion, citing the claim that Shahid Hussein was a paid FBI informant whose mission was to radicalize disaffected Muslims and recruit them to join a fake terror plot. The motion suggests that Hussein was provided with as much as $250,000 for the case and had a government-provided BMW, Hummer, and other cars to make him appear to be a well-funded foreign terrorist operative. The government well knew that their case had been a government-inspired creation from day one and that the defendants had not been independently seeking weapons or targets, the dismissal motion said. This development was by no means a surprise to analysts who have noted that every major domestic terror plot in the United States over the last 2 decades has been aided, abetted, funded, supplied, and often created by paid government informants. 8 years before bombs and nanothermite demolished the World Trade Center in New York, the original 1993 World Trade Center bombing was exposed as an FBI operation. The man who supplied the bomb-making materials to the bombers, a former Egyptian army officer named Imad Salem, was revealed to be an FBI informant who had been told to deliver the materials to the plotters. The original plan was to deliver fake materials so that the bombing could not go ahead, but FBI agents overseeing the case ordered him to give the real supplies to the plotters, and the attack went ahead, killing 6 and injuring 1,042 people. In December of 1993, the head of the FBI New York field office, James N. Fox, issued a blanket denial that the FBI had foreknowledge of the attacks, and the media stopped reporting on the story. Since then, the actual recordings between Salem and his FBI handler, Special Agent John Antichev, have been released.
He was start already building the bomb, which is went off in the World Trade Center. It was built by supervision from the Bureau and the DA, and we was all informed about it, and we know that the bomb start to be built. By who? By your confidential informant. What a wonderful, great case. And then he put his head in the sand and said, oh, no, that's not true. Okay, well, it's built with a different way in another place, and that's it.
Well, don't make any list. You know, I'm just trying to be as honest with you as I can.
Of course, I appreciate that.
And as far as the the payments go and everything like that, they're there. I guarantee you that they are there.
In 2007, convicted Oklahoma City bombing co-conspirator Terry Nichols was able to file an affidavit in U.S. District Court in Utah, alleging that the OKC bombing and Timothy McVeigh had been directed by a high-ranking FBI official. The affidavit indicated that Nichols had been trying to go public with the information about McVeigh's FBI help for years, but had been prevented from speaking to the press. He had also contacted former Attorney General John Ashcroft with the information, but never received a reply. In 2006, it was revealed that the so-called Miami 7, who had allegedly been attempting to strike targets in the U.S., including the Sears Tower, had in fact been organized, led, and supplied by a government informant who had convinced them that he was an Al-Qaeda operative. The case disappeared from the headlines after it became apparent that the men were in fact a group of unemployed underachievers with below-average cognitive abilities living in a warehouse. In 2008, the so-called Fort Dix terror plot was also revealed to be the single-handed creation of two FBI informants who created a plot to stir six foreign-born Muslims into taking on the U.S. Army at Fort Dix. The plot was foiled when the dim-witted conspirators asked a Circuit City employee to transfer their jihad training video onto DVD and asked police for maps to the Fort Dix Army base. Analysts are expecting this latest revelation to also be quickly swept under the rug by the corporate media, and for the next large-scale domestic terror bust to be reported as if none of these previous incidents ever took place.
And that brings us to San Bernardino. As many of you already know, there's an amazing coincidence of drills being conducted right before these terrorist attacks happen, and the drills mimic exactly what happens. So, for example, on 9/11, there were many drills being conducted concerning America being attacked by terrorists. There were drills at the Boston Marathon bombing, drills prior to the Oklahoma City bombing, drills the morning of the 7/7 bombings in London in 2005, which took place at the exact four same locations and the exact same times as the real bombs. And there were drills on the morning of the recent Paris attacks, and there were drills prior to the recent San Bernardino shootings. Now, it seems to me that this is a huge red flag that another major deception is underway. In a December 7th article by Countercurrent News called "Eyewitness to San Bernardino Terror Attack Still Says Three Tall White Men Did It," the article goes on to say, quote, "The controversy over what really happened in San Bernardino last week is just beginning to heat up. Right after the lawyers for the alleged attacker's family said that they do not believe the suspects did it, yet another eyewitness to the attacks maintained that the real attackers were three tall, athletic, Caucasian men in tactical gear. It looked like their skin color was white. They appeared to be tall," the eyewitness said. Investigators with the ATF recovered police-issued firearms from the alleged shooters. So what we've been told about the San Bernardino shooting so far is already starting to look suspicious and even fraudulent. So now let's move on to take a look at ISIS. Here's what Professor Michelle Chusadovsky has to say in a recent article called "America's War on Terrorism: The Truth Will Prevail." It was posted on the website globalresearch.ca on November 27th, 2015. And here goes. Amply documented but rarely mentioned in mainstream news, ISIS is a creation of U.S. intelligence, recruited, trained, and financed by the U.S. and its allies, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Israel, and Jordan.
Those who ordered the bombing campaign are those who are behind the caliphate project. The Islamic State militia, which is currently the alleged target of a U.S.-NATO bombing campaign under a, quote, counterterrorism mandate, is supported covertly by the United States and its allies. What this means is that the ISIS terrorists are the foot soldiers of the Western alliance. While America claims to be targeting ISIS, in reality, it is protecting ISIS. The air campaign is intent upon destroying Syria and Iraq rather than going after the terrorists. There's lots of evidence that the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, Qatar, and Jordan are behind ISIS, but you won't hear much about that in the controlled media. Here's what author, journalist, and former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under the Reagan administration has to say about the media.
You can't trust the Western media anymore.
And here's what he has to say about ISIS.
Washington has been, until the Paris attacks, very protective of ISIS. Indeed, it's a Washington creation. Washington created it. This has been admitted on television by the former director of the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, who says flat out, yes, we created ISIS. And Washington, of course, is using ISIS to try to overthrow Assad. So it's hard to see how Washington's agenda can coincide with Russia's. And it's hard to see how France's agenda, if they actually believe ISIS was responsible for the Paris attacks, it's hard to see how France could go along with Washington. And so we see here some potential breakup in NATO, which would be a good thing.
ISIS took credit for the recent Paris attacks. But since we know who's really behind ISIS, what does this really mean? Here's an interview from November 2015 on Russia Today with political journalist and author Geroid O. Kolmain to provide some geopolitical clarity.
Well, let's now talk to political journalist and author Geroid O. Kolmain, who joins us from Paris this evening. Thanks very much for joining us again on RT International. You're in the French capital. What's the mood and atmosphere in the city right now?
We're being told that there's a state of war and a state of emergency. We've had this before. We had this in January, and for several weeks we had nonstop sirens and nonstop chatter on the radio about the threat from radical Islam and terrorist groups and so on. And so we're having a kind of a replay of that, but it has been, I think, accentuated, and we're going to have an intensification of the media campaign, which is essentially a propaganda campaign to make people in France fear Muslims. We need to be clear about the origin of the war on terror. The war on terror is, I quote, orchestrated from abroad. These are the words François Hollande used to describe this terrorist attack. Well, the attacks that have been continuing to destroy Syria, to massacre its population, have also been orchestrated from abroad. They were orchestrated by NATO, and they've been carrying these attacks out against the civilian population of Syria for 4 years now. And this is a terrorist campaign that is also orchestrated from abroad. And people in Europe need to understand that there is what is becoming global that is being waged against civilian populations in particular. It is a form of neo-imperialism and neo-colonialism, which aims to divide and conquer European and Middle Eastern and African and the world's population, for that matter, and to make them submit to a global order that does not serve most of the people, that very elite, very small, tiny, and particularly tyrannical ruling elite. There is no war on terror. There is a war that is being waged using proxy groups, terrorist proxy groups, and they are being used against nation states who are resisting U.S. and Israeli hegemony, and they are also being used as a means of disciplining forces in Europe. In a period of mass unemployment and austerity, you now have terrorist attacks being committed by terrorists funded, armed, and trained by Western intelligence agencies. There is no such thing as ISIS. ISIS is a creation of the United States. We know that from official sources of the U.S. military themselves, declassified documents from the intelligence intelligence agency have confirmed that. And the French are now, the French government is now attempting to drum up support for more military intervention in Syria. And what they want to do is they want to get in on the game. The game is almost lost. The Russians have routed much of the Islamic State, of Islamic militants coming into Europe disguised as refugees. That will destabilize Central Europe. And the French government wants to get in on the game in Syria and prop up those so-called moderate rebels. There are no moderate rebels, of course, in Syria. There are Al-Qaeda and ISIS militants, terrorists who have been beheading people, eviscerating people, absolutely creating chaos and genocide right across the region, and this does not serve the Syrian people or anyone other than the Western corporate elites and their geopolitical interests.
What do you expect France to do now in the light not only of Friday's terrorism, but 10 months on from Charlie Hebdo? It's not going to ease up on what it's doing, is it?
No. Much depends on how the French public will react. We are being bombarded now with a media propaganda campaign. There's this non-stop talk where we're told not to go out in the street. We're supposed to be fearful and keep quiet and so on. I think there is going to be a campaign against dissidents in France. They're very worried about the new media that has emerged in recent years, and they are very worried about the alternative media. So I think there you will see, we saw this actually after the attacks in January, you will see a conflation of terrorism and dissidents. So one of the tools which the mass media uses to discredit any kind of rational questioning of the established order, and particularly the war on terrorism, is to deride those who would question the war on terrorism as conspiracy theorists. And I think you're going to see a crackdown on so-called conspiracy theorists and websites that actually publish rational and honest analysis of what is happening. So you're going to see more of that type of intellectual terrorism, which is already at a boiling point in France. I mean, it's got to the point now where you have professors in universities who are being intimidated. You have school teachers who are basically being fired for even suggesting that there may be a link between French imperialism and terrorism. There was one case recently, for example, of a school teacher who almost lost his job when he suggested there might be a link between French foreign policy and terrorism. So we are going through a period of deep intellectual terrorism. And, of course, these random terrorist acts, which are a form of low-intensity civil war. I think that the current crisis, the refugee crisis, which is really a form of coercive engineered migration, because it could have easily have been prevented, this form of coercive engineered migration is going to make this, and it is going to create the conditions of civil war. It is a natural consequence, of course, of globalization, of financial capitalism. It leads to a breakdown of society. And the only way in which they can kind of keep everybody down is by a policy of divide and conquer. So you're going to see a situation where you've got a very much a Wahhabized working class in France. They're being Wahhabized by the allies of the French political elite, the Saudi Qataris. They're building Wahhabite mosques all over the place. And that is going to Wahhabize the youth, and they're going to be then used as pawns, if you like, in much bigger geopolitical wars, wars, proxy wars against Russia, proxy wars against Iran in the Middle East, and so on. And that is going to create massive social unrest. It's going to divide working people against each other. And the only people are going to actually benefit from this are the war contractors, the military industrial media intelligence complex. So in whatever way you look at this, I don't know who exactly did committed this attack and this atrocity, but the real people who are responsible, whether directly or indirectly or consciously or unconsciously, is the French government, because they have been complicit in terrorism in the Middle East and all over Africa. And that needs to be understood. And if we don't understand that, this is going to continue and it's going to deteriorate. We will find ourselves in a situation under martial law, if this continues. So it really needs to be analysed and understood.
Can I pick you up on the issue of migrants and refugees? Because one of the terrorists appears to have been a French citizen, another a recent migrant to the country. What do you think this will do to France's policies towards the migrant crisis?
Well, I think there is sufficient evidence to suggest strongly, in fact, that the current crisis, I mean, the migration crisis is something that is ongoing, and there are different waves. You've got different waves coming up from Libya, you've got the ones coming up from Syria and up through the Balkans. But the current kind of refugee crisis, as it were, is what I would refer to as coercive engineered migration. This is a term used by Kelly Greenhill, a US academic, who wrote an interesting book on this, whereby she shows that migration can be used as a tool by one state to destabilize another state. In this case, it's definitely being used by the United States and Turkey to destabilize the Balkans, Mitteleuropa, which would be Hungary, and of course Germany. And the reason, the geostrategic reasons for this are basically go back to classical geopolitics, which is Halford Mackinder's theory of the world, of dividing the world island. That is to say, you divide the Eurasian Peninsula from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. You create an intermarium there so that you prevent German and Russian unity. And that is why Germany essentially is being kind of overrun with people who are themselves victims of globalization, but they are now being instrumentalized and used as weapons of globalization. And this is one of the key contemporary strategies of US imperialism. You use the consequences of globalization as further tools to further globalization. And I think there is no policy in Europe to control immigration or anything like that. I think that the key question here is not actually controlling immigration. The key question is stopping this geopolitical destabilization of Europe. Some countries are attempting to do that. Hungary is attempting to do that. Bulgaria is attempting to a certain extent to do that. In other words, trying to find out who's an actual refugee and who isn't. They're prioritizing women and children, for example, in Hungary. That's a rational approach. But of course, Viktor Orban of Hungary is being demonized by the European Union for his insistence on implementing the laws of the European Union and of the Hungarian nation state. Here, you're in a situation where the French government is totally subordinate to US dictates. This is a country that has been completely taken over by US imperialism, just as Germany. And France doesn't really have a foreign policy. It does whatever Washington tells it to do.
And again, that was author and political journalist Geroid Okolmane in a November interview on RT. So, we have all of this state-sponsored terrorism being blamed on Muslims to move the U.S. and its allies' political agenda forward. But Russia has entered the picture, and its air support for Syria's fight for survival against ISIS has changed the duplicitous game the West has been playing. The Russians are actually getting rid of ISIS. What's the West to do? Well, for starters, perhaps shoot down some Russian planes and try to make it look like it's actually fighting its own creation, ISIS. Here's part of an article that was posted on the Activist Post on December 2, 2015, called U.S. Gives ISIS 45-Minute Warning Before Bombs Runs Out of Ammo Against ISIS Target. And it was written by Brandon Turbeville. And here goes. Ever since the Russians began dropping real bombs on real ISIS targets in Syria, the United States and NATO have been forced to engage in a two-sided propaganda campaign that swears opposition to ISIS while simultaneously doing everything it can to facilitate and protect ISIS forces on the ground. It has also found itself in the bizarre position of trying to facilitate the death squad army while at the same time attempting to play catch-up to the Russians in at least the appearance of bombing ISIS. Thus, when Russian forces truly hit at one of the sources of ISIS funding, the captured oil being shipped from Syria and Iraq to Turkey, where it is purchased by Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan's son, Bilal, the United States must then engage in its own faux bombing campaign against ISIS oil trucks. Yet, instead of actually bombing the trucks, drivers and all, and putting them out of commission permanently, the U.S. bombing campaign takes a form of a laughable formality that involves a 45-minute warning to the oil convoys that a U.S. bombing campaign is about to take place. The warning involves an airdrop of leaflets to the tankers that read, "Get out of your trucks now and run away from them. Warning, airstrikes are coming. Oil trucks will be destroyed. Get away from your oil trucks immediately. Do not risk your life." The justification is that the drivers of the tankers might be civilians and not actual ISIS members. Of course, there's no mention of the fact that in any other context, an individual who renders material support to terrorists, particularly in the form of driving tankers of stolen oil in a war zone that will be used to fund the terrorist organization, would be killed without question under that designation. There's also no mention as to why these potential civilians received ample warning, but true civilians received no such courtesy. It is truly a pity that the U.S. did not drop leaflets to the million Iraqis it has killed over the last decade or the thousands of Libyans that died at the hands of NATO. Still, one only need look at the numbers of destroyed oil tankers racked up by the U.S. in comparison to the Russians to see a distinct difference. The United States, according to Colonel Stephen Warren, has taken out only 116 tankers since the bombing campaign began, while the Russians have eliminated over 1,000 in 5 days. Remember, until the Russians began bombing the oil tankers, the United States had yet to launch an attack on them. Even more laughable was the response that came when the U.S. military was questioned as to why they were unable to destroy more trucks than they did after such a highly publicized strategy. According to Army Colonel Steve Warren, the American jets simply ran out of ammo in the process. Quote, the goal was to destroy every truck there. They ran out of ammunition before they were able to do that. But the desire was to destroy every single truck there, he said. Even with the new attempt to be seen as truly aimed at fighting ISIS in the eyes of the gullible American public, the U.S. has been forced to use videos and photographs from Russian bombings to purvey across the mainstream media due to the fact that American strikes on ISIS oil trucks are so rare. And then here's an article posted on Press TV on November 22, 2015, called Media Manipulation. U.S. shows footage of Russian airstrike against ISIS as its own. And I'm just going to read you parts of that. So here goes. On November 16, the U.S. military claimed it had destroyed 116 tanker trucks carrying stolen Syrian oil from those fields, but failed to provide video evidence. 2 days later, however, the Russian Air Force destroyed some 500 oil trucks and promptly released footage of the airstrike. On November 19, a program dubbed PBS NewsHour used the Russian footage and passed them off as U.S. airstrikes without revealing the true source. And speaking of lies and the media, I'd like to correct a lie that Donald Trump recently told when he claimed to have watched thousands of Muslims cheering in Jersey City, New Jersey on 9/11. Even CNN said that didn't happen. But what they didn't tell you is that there were actually people cheering in Jersey City on 9/11, but they weren't Muslims. They were five young Israelis in a white moving van who were observed taking photos of themselves in Liberty Park against the smoking ruins of the Twin Towers in the background. They were arrested and released a few months later, and at least two of them were Mossad agents. To learn more about them, just do a search for the dancing Israelis. So all of these wars in the Middle East, falsely justified by the phony war on terror, only made possible by a lying, complicit media, could be ended quickly with the exposure of the truth about 9/11, which proves that Muslim terrorists didn't do it. If you don't already get this, go to ae911truth.org and start your own research. And read Christopher Boleyn's book, Solving 9/11, The Lives of Many People May Depend on It. I'll end the show with some quotes by Paul Craig Roberts. And here goes. The war on terror is a hoax. We don't have to stand for this. We can turn off Fox News, CNN, NPR, and all the rest of the prostitutes who lie for a living. We can cease purchasing the useless newspapers. We can demand that the police spy state that was created entirely on the basis of lies and deceptions be rolled back. Are the American people really such washed-up sheeple, such cowards, that they acquiesce to a police spy state, the foundation of which consists of nothing but lies told by criminals and repeated endlessly by whores pretending to be journalists? If so, the American people are not a people who any longer matter, and they will continue to be treated by Washington and by their local police as people who do not matter. And finally, unless the American people come to their senses and expel the Washington warmongers, war is our future. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Massive demonstrations in Puerto Rico as teachers union fights austerity.
Our wonderful demonstrator activists, educators, the teachers of Puerto Rico, the teachers union, which is fighting austerity. And we're going to find out so much more about what they've been up to and what they've been up to when faced with the horrific austerity plans, the potential bankruptcy of Puerto Rico, and the otherwise horrific money that is pouring in and is being exploited by the hedge fund developers. And with that, Mercedes Martinez, who's the president of the Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico, let's begin with telling us about who the Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico is and what are the fundamental issues that you're dealing with.
Well, the Federación de Maestros de Puerto Rico is a rank-and-file union-based union that unites teachers from all of our islands here in Puerto Rico. And we are struggling the same struggles that our brothers and sisters in the States are giving right now against austerity measures. Right now, today, we went to court to fight for a Christmas bonus that the government is supposed to give us and is taken away from us. We are facing the possible closure or shutdown of more than 600 schools, the privatization of 15% of our schools. They want to implement a new teacher evaluation system using 20% of the students' standardized testing test scores. To apply it in order to lay off thousands of teachers in our country. So definitely we are giving a huge struggle united with other teacher organizations here in our country to fight back and to win, obviously.
Now, things are obviously going to get a lot hotter after the new year when the large $1 billion debt comes due. But let's talk a bit about recently how you've been fighting all of these cutbacks that have occurred in the last months, and while I don't want to get back years because we could talk for hours because you have a very militant union which has been protesting for years, but how have you been protesting in the last, say, 6 months against the cutbacks? What form have the cutbacks taken, and what kind of alliances have you had, especially with the students and the teachers and the parents?
Well, I became the president right now in July this year, but have been in the union for many years. This semester we faced, in August 23rd, we did a march. Hundreds of teachers were marching through the on streets of San Juan. In September, we did another march with a lot of unions from all around our country. On October, with the General Assembly of the workers in our country, to develop a plan to fight back as a class. This is a class struggle, so workers from the energy department, water department, and different employees and workers all around our country gathered together to develop a plan to fight back together. In November, we had a one-day strike with other teacher unions. It's called the Frente Amplio and Defensa de la Escuela Pública, where different teachers unions got together and joined together to fight back against the austerity measures that I talked about at the beginning. And right now we did a civil disobedience on the 11th of December with your teachers unions. On the 16th, we did another civil disobedience in the Department of Treasury, claiming it was ours. And today we were reunited with the subsecretary of education fighting against the punitive teacher evaluation system they want to apply in our country and opposing to it. So we've been keeping very busy, but particularly we've been visiting schools, organizing the teachers, organizing the students, the parents, and all the communities, because we have to fight together as an entire community. Public education is not a thing that you can only leave to teachers. All the community has to get involved, so we're working hard on getting all the parents, students, teachers, and other personnel that work in our schools together to fight back against this.
Mercedes, let me ask you how you would describe the conditions on the island at this point. I should say it was rather interesting that at this this past weekend, there was a three full page in the New York Times about the economics on the island of Puerto Rico and the ravenous, exploitative monies that are coming in and how they are being used by hedge fund developers, among others. How do you help us understand the cost, the expenditures, really the evolution of the debt, which, of course, is going to affect yourself as a worker, as a teacher, and the character of education on the island? Tell us more.
Well, as of the 70s here in Puerto Rico, they created an operation called Operación Manos a la Obra. And in that operation, they converted Puerto Rico to a tax haven island to all hedge funds, developers, and foreign companies. What they do is that they come here to our country, and they are tax-free. They win and make earnings and profits over $35 million, $35,000 per year in our country in profits, and they don't pay any taxes for the profits they make. So the government has recurred to put the country in debt, taking loans at high interest plus corruption, and that has ended in this crisis of more than $72 billion that are owed right now in our country due to these tax credits, and that has been given to all of these foreign companies, developers, and hedge funds throughout these years. For our union, we have no debt. Our country has been exploited for more than 100 years of colonialism, so we don't owe a penny to anybody in the world, and we shouldn't pay back for what they've taken from us. Millions of dollars per year have gone from our country. People are being exploited in their works, giving them harsh working conditions. And now they expect the workers to pay for the crisis that the capitalist and neoliberal government has created in our country. And that is totally unacceptable. We have proposed to the government many, many times at least to make a 10% tax to all these foreign companies, and the crisis will be solved. But they do not want to touch the rich. They want to impoverish the working class, because that's how capitalism works. And they want to impoverish us and leave us without any rights. That's why the workers have to unite together, because this is not one sector that's been affected. It's the entire people from our country that needs to stand together, because all of us are feeling these austerity measures that the government wants to impose. So the only thing that we can do to fight is to fight back, to struggle against this in order for us to obtain a victory.
You mentioned a 10% tax. I mean, frankly, I think it should be more. But what are they paying now?
Right now they're paying, if they're paying, 2%.
Yeah. All right. 10% is better, nothing. But let's try 20. Okay.
Well, I understand
what
that.
Want, what we get.
And it's a tax-free paradise for all the hedge funds. Mm. I agree with you. It should be more than their percent. But even if they would only pay that little bit of amount, the problem of the supposed crisis would be resolved.
Well, this is not just the hedge funds. The corporations are paying almost no taxes also, like Walmart.
Walmart, Walgreens, Sears, all those foreign companies that come to our country and people here pay more. It's impossible for the workers to be paying an 11.5% sales tax on their salary. And we have these big corporations paying 2% and making millions. It makes no sense. Christmas bonus has not been paid. That's why today we had to go to court. We sent an injunction, and we're waiting for a court decision in favor of the workers, because they've taken this too far. And obviously, we need to organize our communities, because this is only going to get harder after January, when they're threatening to close the government because they're saying there's no money to pay the workers. They want to continue imposing these measures that are going to leave the working class in complete poverty. And definitely what we're doing and other unions are doing is the right thing and the right way to go. We have to go to every school. We have to go to every teacher. We have to go to every parent, every worker, every citizen that's been affected by this alleged crisis that we have to pay, that we have no fault, and it's not our problem. We are clear that this debt is not ours.
I also
we are clear that we owe nothing, so we should not pay a cent, and the workers are claiming for justice.
And I want to let our listeners know that we're speaking with Mercedes Martinez, president of the Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico. And one of the things I wanted to ask you was, you mentioned earlier the issue of privatization. Now, we see the advance of privatization here in the form of charter schools, and much of other services in Puerto Rico are increasingly moving in the direction of privatization. But what does privatization look like, and who is advocating for that in terms of the education system in Puerto Rico?
Well, right now in Puerto Rico, all the public schools are public. In 2008, the Federación de Maestros went on a strike. The union was the exclusive representative of all teachers, and that strike got us decertified. But for us, it was more important to go to the street and fight against the implementation of charter schools in our country and to obtain teachers' rights than to be the exclusive representative. That attack has been vivid after then, year after year, where these big companies want to take over the control of our schools and administer our schools, creating charter schools. Right now we have no charter schools in our country, and there's a bill going on in the Senate. Right now they're in recession, but in January the session goes back again. And it's called Plan Batia. It's project number 1456. It was already approved by the Senate. Now it's going to the House of Representatives. And what they want to do is they want to create charter schools in 15% of our current schools. According to them, those should be the schools that achieve the lowest in the standardized testing. And for us, that's totally unacceptable. And the beauty of this is that they may approve it by January. And they may have their 5 minutes of glory. But in April, when those tests come, teachers have to prepare for a strike. And if April comes and no teacher gives a test, and students don't take the test, they will not be able to appoint the schools as a failing schools when they're not. They will not be able to point a finger against teachers. And that way they will not be able to put that 20% on the teacher test scores or the 7% on our students' test scores of the general, their average and promedio. And that way, even though they may apply, they may approve the law, it goes hand by hand with the flexibility plan. And now the No Child Left Behind has been reauthorized by the ESSA Act. But they can approve whatever they want. But if April comes and we are able to organize this, and we are able for the test not to be given, they will not be able to implement whatever laws they approve. So more than betting on that, this is not going to go and pass in the House of Representatives. We are preparing for a huge struggle in our country because the existence of public schools are in threat. We've seen what's happened in the States, where thousands of schools have been shut down, where thousands of teachers have been laid off, all because of the standardized market and corporate reformers that see in our children money from these debts. And we are definitely not going to have it. It's going to be a huge struggle, and it's definitely going to take a strike for the teachers to fight this back in order for us to prevail.
Well, let's move to January, which is a little bit closer also, because in January 1st, more than $1 billion debt is due, and there may be more cutbacks, and you mentioned even possible government shutdown. So what kind of alliances are being made now? What are some of the plans for January?
Well, right now we're part of an alliance called Coordinadora Sindical, and that alliance has union members of different classes. It has Deutier, Inas Profesor, workers that work on public transportation, hospital workers, teachers, all the different unions, progressive unions, rank and file unions that have fought for the workers' rights in our country and have a history of fighting against this neoliberal agenda. So what we're doing is that we're uniting, because definitely it's going to take more than one union to fight back against all these cuts that are being threatened against our people. We celebrated an assembly, a national assembly in October, and we approved there that we were going to work for a general strike in all of our country. But obviously, in order for the government to hear us, it cannot be a one-day strike. It has to be indefinite, and that takes a lot of organization to do so. That's why we are having meetings regularly on a weekly basis, seeing where every union is, giving labor classes, labor schools, creating labor schools in our union for all of our members, because we have the only way to organize the workers is going and talking to them directly, meeting with them, sitting down with them, explaining to them what's happening, hearing what's happening, and together working for options. Obviously, we have to develop a class conscience to the workers, and that's a huge amount of work that we are having in our union and all the other
Mercedes
at the same time.
Let me just query in the minute or two that we have left. Ken said your union, the Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico, is more militant. They've been involved in lots of strikes. You use the term progressive, and indeed you talked about neoliberal agendas and colonialism. What do you think the function of your union is? As it is it merely a bread and butter consideration in terms of austerity, or do you see it having a power relationship and the working class having through its organizations, such as unions, a much more a strategic determination over the events and how things unfold in Puerto Rico and for the class.
We have in the Federación de Maestros de Puerto Rico, we have the executive committee. Most of these members have a big influence by socialism. So we have a huge responsibility among our shoulders to develop class consciousness in the people of our country and the workers. We have a big role in the struggle that we're going to have next year. We definitely have to work hand in hand with the other union members together, but it's definitely going to take a huge movement in our country to fight back. We cannot rely on politicians. We cannot rely on political parties. The only thing that we can rely is in ourselves, in our workers, in organizing together to fight back any political party that is going to come to power, because they all do the same thing. They respond to the same capitalist people and movement. So we definitely have a big role and a strategic role in our country to develop this class conscience so the workers can see that it's not an attack on one sector, but it's an attack on an entire
and we're going to. We're going to have to leave it there as we ready ourselves for the next program. Mercedes Martinez, president of the Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico. Do you have a 30-second chant for us? Can you give us one of the favorite chants of the Teachers Union, and we'll take it out with that?
Sure. We have a chant that says, "No hay triunfo sin lucha, ni lucha sin sacrificio."
Say that one more time and then do a translation.
Okay. It says, "No hay triunfo sin lucha." That means there's no triumph without struggle and no struggle without sacrifice.
What a note to end on. Indeed, there isn't. And we'd like to thank you again for joining us. We'll continue to keep our listeners posted as things develop and possibly leading up to a general strike in Puerto Rico. We've been speaking with Mercedes Martinez, president of Teachers Federation of Puerto Rico.
Now Rafael Banabi, who is the Working People's Party candidate for the governor of Puerto Rico in 2012.
The most visible aspect of the crisis in Puerto Rico today is the debt crisis. But as the debt crisis is part of a much bigger crisis, it's part of a crisis which includes the fact that the economy of Puerto Rico has been stagnant for more than a decade. It hasn't grown. We have lost about 250,000 jobs in 10 years. And that economic stagnation is behind that is what you have is the increasingly lack of effectiveness of the government's economic policy, which is based on the policy of tax exemption, which is the notion that you're going to attract foreign investments, you're going to attract U.S. corporations to Puerto Rico by offering to charge them very low or no taxes. And behind that policy of tax exemption, I would argue, you have the very structure of the Puerto Rican economy, which is what one would have to call a colonial structure, which is that the economy of Puerto Rico, ever since the early 20th century, has been controlled, has been dominated by large U.S. corporations that produce different kinds of goods in Puerto Rico that generate a tremendous amount of profit in Puerto Rico, but most of that profit is not reinvested in Puerto Rico. It leaves the island. And since it's not reinvested in Puerto Rico, it doesn't create employment in Puerto Rico. It doesn't create economic growth in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help the development of Puerto Rico. So you have the debt problem, but you have the economic stagnation problem, and you have the problem of the dependent structure of the Puerto Rican economy. And while you have to deal with the debt problem in an immediate sense, you also have to go deeper and see how you're going to restructure the Puerto Rican economy in a different way, because otherwise you're just going to keep reproducing the present situation. Since the crisis has several levels that you have to address, you have to have policies which address every different level. In the more immediate sense, we feel that the debt of Puerto Rico is unsustainable. Puerto Rico cannot pay this debt in the terms that it was originally contracted without inflicting terrible sacrifices, unacceptable sacrifices on the Puerto Rican people, and without foregoing policies that you would need to carry out in order for the economy to recuperate. So in the immediate future, we have to renegotiate that debt to carry out the policies of austerity that the government is proposing in order to pay the debt would only be more unfair for the Puerto Rican people. It would mean more social injustice in Puerto Rico, and it would also be economically inefficient. It would perpetuate the present crisis. We have seen in the last 2 years mobilizations by students at the university, by university workers and both teaching and non-teaching, by teachers in the public school system, workers in the electrical system and other public agencies who have mobilized to defend their pensions, to defend their collective agreements, to defend their wages, and so on. So we should expect that these initiatives will intensify to the degree that the government insists in imposing its austerity policies.
Has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Have to write 15 pages in today's world to explain that gay people are the same as everyone else. Everyone accepts that. And once you accept that, then the constitutional analysis is easy. Because once you assume one group of people is equal, then they have to be treated equally under the law. That's what our Constitution says. Not only did we not want to de-gay the case, we wanted to, like, re-gay the case. I mean, a lot of our practice sessions, the answers I gave, you know, every other word out of my mouth was gay, 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 gay. And if you listen to the argument, I certainly said it quite a bit.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. In the headlines this week, a Slovenian referendum repeals civil marriage equality, Indian lawmakers reject sodomy law reform, but a landmark New Zealand court ruling supports adoptions equality. We'll have details on those and other LGBT stories from around the world when our news wrap crew returns from the year-end holidays. On this week's special program, our correspondent Abby Dees explores the rise and fall of the U.S. Defense of Marriage Act with victorious Supreme Court attorney Roberta Kaplan. Kaplan has just published her personal account of that battle, entitled Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA.
One of the things I really love about the book is that it is also your coming out journey. You actually saw, as a therapist, and you talk about this in the book, Thea Speier, who is the late partner of the plaintiff in the case.
First of all, this is the most rapid civil rights achievement that this country has ever experienced. No group in American history, no minority group, has had the kind of success that LGBT people have as quickly as we have in the last several years. And it's great today that it's the new normal, and no one really bats an eye about people being gay. But because of that, I think it's easy to forget the fact that that very much was not true. Go back to 2004. So I thought it was important to try to explain this incredibly dramatic change. I think you needed to explain where we came from and how much the world has changed.
And I think a lot of people will relate to your own journey. It is very much a universal journey for a lot of us in this community. Could you give me a brief overview of the facts of the case?
Sure. So my client, Edie Windsor, who's 86 and doing great, I'm going to tell you her life story because that really is the facts of the case. She grew up in Philadelphia during the Depression. Her family lost their home and their business during the Depression. She went to college at Temple University. And even though she says she fell in love with a woman in college and she realized she was a lesbian, the idea back then, this was the 50s, that you could ever have a life with another woman, putting aside Patricia Highsmith novels and the movie Carol, the idea that that could ever happen was inconceivable to her. So she had been engaged to a guy. She broke off the engagement in college because of this woman. She then, after college, got reengaged to the guy. That's how she gets the name Windsor. She was married. Needless to say, the marriage did not last very long. She basically said to her husband, she basically came out to him and said, you deserve to be loved the way you deserve to be loved, and I need something else. And like so many people, myself included, a few decades later, she moved to New York City in order to be gay. Anyone who was middle class or up and gay at that point in time had to be completely closeted. You could not live your life otherwise. If you were going to be out, you really were putting yourself at the margins of society, and that's not what most people did. So the bigger problem she had was being a woman. Because it had always occurred to her, or she'd always assumed, that she'd get married and that her husband would support her. That's what women did back then. And now she needed to get a job. So she had been good, apparently, at algebra in high school. So she decided to enter the mathematics graduate program at NYU. She became one of the earliest software programmers in the country. She got a job to work her way through grad school working on what was then the biggest computer in the world called the UNIVAC computer, which was operated by the Atomic Energy Commission. In order to keep that job, she needed, and no pun intended here, but she needed Q security clearance. One day she got a letter from the FBI saying, "We don't think you need a lawyer yet, but we'd like to talk to you." She was petrified, and she was right to be petrified, because back then it was a felony. It was a crime for anyone who was gay or lesbian to have any employment with the federal government whatsoever.
And back then, we're talking the 50s.
This is the late 50s, and you couldn't even work for a company that had contracts with the government, like IBM, as Edie later did. That was also illegal. So she did a little research under New York law. Back then, according to her research, for a lesbian, as opposed to a gay man, and the law was different, for a lesbian, what was illegal was to dress as a man. So Edie shows up at her FBI interview in high heels, a frilly dress, and crinolines, hoping, as she said, to throw the FBI off their game. Fortunately for Edie, and fortunately, I would say, for U.S. history, the FBI only really cared about whether her sister had friends who were in the teachers' union and who were communists, and they never asked her whether she was a lesbian. But imagine that today. I mean, especially for people younger than me, the idea that you could be called in, asked whether you were gay, knowing that if you told the truth, and Edie was determined to tell the truth, that that would not only be the end of your job, but the end of your career.
Yeah.
So time went on. She got a job at IBM, as I mentioned. She did extremely well there. She had a fellowship at Harvard and then came back to New York. And she said she was the only person in her building who ever wore jeans. She decided to call a friend and said, kind of desperate, saying, "I'm so lonely. I don't know any lesbians. Can you please take me where the lesbians go?" And her friend took her to a restaurant in the Village, then operated by Elaine Kaufman, who went on to start Elaine's, which on Friday nights, apparently, lesbians went to. And at the restaurant, some friends brought over a woman by the name of Thea Spire to her table. As far as Edie was concerned, it was love at first sight. Not the same for Thea. Thea had a series of girlfriends over the next 2 years, and Edie kept kind of waiting. She finally heard the news that Thea was single and was going out to the Hamptons for a weekend. And so she begged some people who really weren't even friends. They were acquaintances. She called them up and said, "Would you mind if I come and stay at your house for the weekend?" They agreed. And that was the beginning. And then they went on to spend the next 40 years of their lives together. A couple years after that, Thea pulled over by the side of the road and pulled out a circular diamond pin and said to Edie, this was 1967, "Will you marry me?" The reason she had a pin instead of a ring is because Edie had said to her, "I can't show up with a diamond ring at work because everyone will want to know who's the lucky guy." To me, the idea that two women in 1967
were thinking this way,
could even have the thought enter their heads that they could get engaged. Stonewall happened 2 years later. And then the truly heroic part of their lives is what happened for the next 40 years, because Thea was diagnosed with a really terrible form of multiple sclerosis. And over time, she lost the use of her legs and then her arms. And by the end time she died, she was quadriplegic. Edie has said that that diagnosis happened to both of them. They had a refrigerator magnet that said, "Seize joy." And they really tried to live that. And the day that Thea died, she actually had patients she was supposed to see. So they really made sure as little in their life change as possible. They wanted to get married. They couldn't get married in New York. And Edie had said to Thea, "Let's go to Canada." And one day, Thea got a very bad diagnosis from the doctors that said that she didn't really have much more time to live. And even though in the past she'd been reluctant to travel, because if you're paralyzed, traveling is really, really hard, she woke up the next morning and she said to Edie, "Do you still want to get married?" Edie said, "I do." And they went to Toronto with four best women and two best men, someone who could disassemble and reassemble the wheelchair. They got married at the Toronto Airport Hilton so they could wheel the wheelchair directly to the room. Sadly, a couple years later, Thea passed away. And that's how the case really started. That was a very long preamble. I'm sorry.
But it's a great story. I don't get tired of it.
That's how the case really started, because upon Thea's death, Edie realized that she had to pay essentially a tax on being gay, that all the property that they had accumulated over their many years together, it was as if Edie had inherited it from a stranger. So she got this whopping $350,000 estate tax bill. She paid it. You have to do that if you want to fight it. So she paid the bill. And then she went looking for a lawyer. And that's how the case started.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with Roberta Kaplan, attorney and author of the book Then Comes Marriage, about her fight against DOMA. Really, the crux of the case was, at least Section 3 of DOMA said that the federal government would not recognize these relationships as a matter of course.
DOMA is an extraordinary law in a lot of ways, or was an extraordinary law in a lot of ways. You know, it was passed in 1996 at a time when there really, I mean, no gay couples were getting married anywhere. There was some kind of faint hint of it maybe happening in Hawaii, but it really wasn't a realistic prospect anywhere. And so Congress passed a law that says if it ever does happen, those marriages are invalid.
We're just, you know, locking the doors just in case.
Exactly. We just want to treat gay people as different just because they're gay.
And that legislative history really came back to destroy it. A key part of your argument was that it was so clearly passed out of fear and what's legally called animus.
Yeah, exactly right. It's not like Congress in 1996 did studies to figure out, you know, what would be bad or good policy. It's not like they looked at the tax implications or the Social Security implications or anything like that. And they say in the House report they're doing it based on moral disapproval of homosexuality. And in Justice Kennedy's constitutional jurisprudence, that's a constitutional no-no. You can't pass a bill just because
people are different.
Yeah. Correct.
Since this year's big case, Obergefell v. Hodges, which ended marriage discrimination, at least legal marriage discrimination, what do you think the legacy of Windsor should be, or how should history remember Windsor?
What was amazing is Windsor got the decision in June 2013, and what happened over the next 2 years was truly extraordinary. There has never been a tidal wave of court cases like this, again, ever in U.S. history, where case after case after case, judges in states like Utah and Oklahoma and Virginia all agreeing that what Windsor meant is that gay people have to be treated equally under the law and equally in marriage. Windsor basically says that gay people have equal dignity. Justice Kennedy uses the word dignity 11 times in 23 pages in the Windsor. He says over and over and over again that gay people have dignity just like everyone else and that that dignity needs to be respected under the law. And that's the principle that led to Obergefell, which basically says the exact same thing. In fact, in Obergefell, he actually uses the phrase equal dignity. You don't have to write 15 pages in today's world to explain that gay people are the same as everyone else. Everyone accepts that. And once you accept that, then the constitutional analysis is easy. Because once you assume one group of people is equal, then they have to be treated equally under the law. That's what our Constitution says.
What was the pushback from some of the other organizations originally?
I suspect that it had to do with the concern that Americans wouldn't get Edie's story because they would see her as kind of this privileged white lady who had a lot of money and had to pay a lot of money in estate taxes. It's not an issue that concerned me at all. First of all, Edie's not that privileged. The estate tax was really because they bought an apartment in Manhattan in 1980. And like anyone who bought an apartment in Manhattan in 1980, it made a lot of money in terms of value. And that's why the estate tax was so high, number one. Number two, I think every American gets in their gut what it means to have to pay a tax that's unjust, a tax for being gay. That's part of our culture. We don't like to pay taxes anyway. Call me crazy, but I think our country was started based on a fight about an unfair tax. I mean, I've been teaching, you know, colonial history to my 9-year-old son, so I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. And the amount here was actually the perfect amount because it was a huge damage. It wasn't like just paying, you know, a $50 filing fee for bankruptcy court. This was really a hit to the
gut. It's real money.
It's real money. And I think Americans all got that. And I know the justices got that. And then there's the story. I mean, there's one thing I know about life, which is no one knows what life has in store for you, right? No one knows that you, God forbid, you could wake up in 2 days and get a diagnosis of MS the way Thea did. The one thing, however, I think we all know is if that happens to us, we would really like to have a spouse like Edie Windsor at our side. Talk about a marriage in sickness and in health, till death did they part. I mean, this was a marriage, and I knew that Americans would get that.
Abby Dees continues her conversation with DOMA Slayer Roberta Kaplan after this very important message.
Hi, I'm News Wrap reporter Rick Watts. It's that time of the year again when many of our U.S. listeners consider ways to maximize their annual charitable tax deductions.
And I'm News Wrap reporter Natalie Peoples. No matter where you are in the world, we need your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to do your part to keep this nonprofit volunteer-based program going.
You'll find some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives as our way of saying thank you. And those CDs make unique holiday gifts, too.
Please go to thiswayout.org to support our efforts to inform, entertain, and educate listeners around the world. Or use Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
From the This Way Out family to you and yours, happy holidays and thank you.
And now the conclusion of Abby D's conversation with trailblazing marriage equality attorney Roberta Kaplan.
One of the themes in the book and one of the themes in the case, sort of your rallying cry, was it's all about Edie.
I had a post-it, especially when we got to the Supreme Court, I had a post-it on my computer that said, borrowing from, I think it was George Stephanopoulos in the first Clinton campaign, said, it's all about Edie Stupid. You know, I think there were two reasons I had it up there. One was conscious and one was unconscious. The conscious reason was we thought from day one that if we could persuade Americans, if we could persuade judges, and ultimately if we got there, if we could persuade the justices of the Supreme Court, that the marriage that Edie and Thea had was the same as anyone else's marriage. Not that different than the marriage that Justice Ginsburg, for example, had. She lost her husband and she would understand. If we could persuade them of that, we would win the case. And that was the way to win the case. We didn't want it anymore to be an abstract fight between the right and the left. We want it to be about real people in their lives. That's what All About Edie was. If you look at our Supreme Court brief on the merits, it's called a red brief. The first 8 pages are Edie and Thea's love story. There's not a lot of Supreme Court briefs that look like that, but again, we did it for a reason. So that's that. The second reason, which I don't think I realized until after the case, is I think I was trying to tell myself that even though I was a married lesbian who was being adversely impacted by DOMA, that my job as a lawyer, as is my job as a lawyer for any client, is to only think about Edie and to put my own situation and my own mishigas behind and aside and to only focus on Edie. And so I think I had it up there kind of to remind myself of that too. And we really did. We made every single decision on the case based on one criteria and one criteria only, which is, will doing X or doing Y help Edie get her money back? And if that's how you make decisions in a case, it makes most of your decisions very easy.
And that's tricky because the whole world is watching and we all know that our marriages are riding on this.
Yeah, nah, believe me. I get that. I mean, there were times, you know, when I felt like, you know, I had 7 tons riding on my shoulders, but the case was all about Edie. Part of that is that's how you win cases. That's what our legal system's about. You're not supposed to be debating abstract principles in courts for the most part. A lot of judges don't like that. They have busy schedules and they want cases about a real, what's called a case or controversy, a real issue. I remember when I argued in the Second Circuit, I said to the judge, I opened by saying, this case is about a widow who wants her money back.
Simple as that. And it does seem to me, just reading, I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but looking at Kennedy's opinion in the end, I think he saw that.
Oh, there's no question he did. He is unique on the Supreme Court at this point in American history because no justice has so dominated an area the way that he has dominated gay rights. He's written all 4 major gay rights decisions by the Supreme Court.
And everybody's watching him for these cases.
And everyone's watching him. I don't know him personally, so I can't tell you what goes on in his head, obviously. But I suspect he's very proud of his legacy in that.
He was a Reagan appointee, I believe.
Yes. I understand he's a religious Catholic. I actually think that his conception of dignity that comes out so much in these opinions is based on his view, a view that I share, that God created everyone in the image of God, every single human being. And that means that every single human being has dignity and that that dignity needs to be respected.
Yeah.
I think one of the mistakes that our movement made is to cede religious arguments to the other side and to make it look like anyone who was religious was anti-gay. That's not true.
And there were a lot of front of the court briefs in Windsor from religious people and religious institutions, to your point exactly.
Yeah, that was one of my major obsessions in the case. I really wanted a religious brief, not only from all the gay religious groups, which we've always had, I wanted from mainstream religious groups. So I wanted not the gay Catholics, I wanted the Catholics. I wanted not the gay Jews, I wanted the Jews. And we really got that.
Do you think that those make a difference?
Yes, no question. I mean, the first brief that we got on the other side was from the Westboro Baptist Church. And we were like, to quote the character in my son's favorite movie, Beauty and the Beast, we were like, be my guest. You want to file an amicus brief on the other side? Feel free.
Let's see your colors fly.
On our side, I immediately, when they took Windsor, asked Mary Bonato to come in and run that. And she did a great job of kind of corralling the various groups. And there were, I think, 3 briefs that were the most important. Or maybe 4. The first was the religious brief we've already talked about. The second, this was very important, was briefs about the military. After Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been repealed, in large part as the result of a good friend of mine, Jay Johnson, who was then the general counsel of the Pentagon and is now Secretary of Homeland Security, they had a real problem in the military because there were a lot of openly gay soldiers who, not surprisingly, were married, because people go in the military tend to be people who want to get married. Because of DOMA, however, they were not married for purpose of federal law. And so it had already happened that from time to time, one of those soldiers got seriously injured or even killed. And the military leadership was not able to notify their spouse that that had happened. And in military culture, that is a big deal. You know, how you tell someone or their family that they've been injured or died is a big deal. And it was driving the Pentagon crazy. It was such an indignity to these soldiers and to their honor. So that brief was very important. We had a brief from the military. Frankly, a brief from business was very important. We had 271 businesses in Windsor. I think by the time it got to Obergefell, it was like 400-something. Even in Windsor, we had companies begging to be put on while we were taking the brief to the printer. I mean, it was already too late. You have to play to your audience. So it was important for the justices to see that this is a mainstream issue for many Americans.
And those issues rise above politics.
Exactly.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with Roberta Kaplan, attorney and author of the book Then Comes Marriage, about her fight against DOMA. You got a lot of backseat drivers as you were preparing this case. And one of the suggestions that you got was to de-gay the case.
We got a lot of advice, and we would listen to all of it. We would accept some. We would reject some. But one piece of advice that we got that really stuck out was this idea that the way to win the case was to de-gay it, to rely instead on some earlier Supreme Court cases, one of which involves hippies and one of which involved mentally disabled people, and that we should really rely on those precedents rather than talk so much about Edie being gay. And my view at the time was that, frankly, I don't think today's Supreme Court would necessarily decide the hippie case the same way today. I don't know about the mentally disabled people, but certainly the hippie case. And I didn't really want to compare gay people to people who are mentally disabled. I wasn't crazy about that analogy. And I thought, you know, as I said earlier, that the way to win the case is to persuade the court that we are like everyone else. And so not only did we not want to de-gay the case, we wanted to like re-gay the case. I mean, you know, a lot of our practice sessions, you know, the answers I gave, you know, every other word out of my mouth was gay, 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 gay. And if you listen to the argument, I certainly said it quite a bit.
What's next?
I think the governments can't discriminate anymore. I think that issue is now resolved. But the big open question out there is, can private employers, in terms of accommodations, discriminate against gay people? I think the answer to that question is both legal and non-legal. The non-legal answer to it is that American businesses have no interest in doing so. I mean, it's terrible business for them. They don't want to have a store manager at some store somewhere, some Walmart or wherever, be able to make decisions about whether they're going to sell something to a family because they're gay or not. That's like a public relations nightmare for business. So you're seeing a lot of the strongest opposition to these bills, frankly, are coming from business. And I think that's the reason. But you're still going to have these one-offs. You're going to have these Kim Davises who want their, what did Warhol say, 2 minutes of fame, 20 minutes?
15.
15 today. In today's world, it's probably longer with social media. But, you know, people like the attention. So Kim Davis is out there. In a way, I think she's been a huge gift to our movement. I'm delighted that Kim Davis did this. First of all, her legal arguments are ridiculous because she's a public servant and she can't pick and choose what parts of the Constitution she's going to follow. Two, when you look at the people supporting her, the rallies and stuff, and you see people with swastikas and white robes, it really conveys how hateful our opposition is. And I think that's a good thing. I think Americans have realized that. And then on top of that, here's the icing on the cake. She lies about a meeting with the Pope. Frankly, it doesn't get better than that. There must be some special category of sin for lying about the Pope.
When you sat down to write your book, Then Comes Marriage, as you look back over all this, was there anything that sort of themes or understanding of what happened now that you didn't see at the time?
Two things are important. One, I think I had forgotten or not realized how much the world changed even within the 4 years, really, that we litigated the case. We started, when we first met Edie in 2009, we got the decision in 2013. And even within those 4 years, I think in large part because of Edie, the world changed dramatically. We look back at some of the older emails in the case. You know, we were seeing the world through a different lens. Even to me, I'm, you know, queen lesbian at this point. But even to me, that was surprising. And then if you go back even farther in history to the years when I was in college or law school, you know, it's healthy and human and mentally healthy to forget. But I had forgotten how bad the world was. You know, I'd forgotten how scared I was to come out, how right I was to be scared to come out, what the world was like during the AIDS crisis when gay men were literally dying in droves and no one cared. We changed the world. I mean, this is a community that changed the world, and that's an incredible thing. couple months after the decision, my son, who was then 7, is obsessed with movies. And so we decided we were going to have a family movie night. And I said, I put my foot down and I said, I cannot watch another Disney cartoon. I said, we're going to pick the movie and, you know, hopefully you'll like it. And so we picked My Fair Lady. He watched the whole movie and afterwards he said, I have two questions. And we said, okay. And he said, first of all, he said, I don't understand why Eliza went back to Henry Higgins. He's like, he treated her so badly. Like, why would you do that? My wife and I could not have been prouder. We clearly are doing at least something right with our son. And then he's like, and the second question is, he said, I guess this is an old-fashioned movie. And we said, yeah, Jacob, it's old-fashioned. He said, yeah. He said, I guess this was made before men could marry men. And exactly, we had the same, it hit us that in my son's view of the world, something is old-fashioned if it happened before men could marry men. I mean, that pretty much says it all.
What a great marker. How is Edie doing?
She's great. We should all do and look the way Edie does at the age of 86. We kind of have a little bit of conflict because I think she often doesn't rest as much as she should. We spent a week together in P-Town this summer and had a great time, and she's really at this point a part of my family.
Oh, that's wonderful.
This is Abby Dees. I've been talking with Roberta Kaplan, the lead attorney for the plaintiff Edie Windsor in U.S. v. Windsor, also the author of the book, Then Comes Marriage. You can find out more about the book and about what Roberta Kaplan's doing at her website, www.robbiekaplan, RobbieKaplan.com. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next time on This Way Out.
It's time we get away to the movies and magic.
Hello, I'm Steve Pride. Join me on the next This Way Out for my annual look at Pride on Screen. This year's edition is not a countdown, but a sit-down.
Well, they said we have to tab you something, so that's how tab came about.
With the heroes and icons behind this exciting year in queer cinema.
I actually had to create the LGBT distribution model.
That's Pride on Screen 2015 on the next This Way Out.
And as we sleigh ride out to Grandma's house.
Happy whatever.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. Abby Dees contributed program material this week with a hearty thanks to producer Steve Pride. The Therapy Sisters performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out has been brought to you throughout the year by the generosity of our listeners. Thank you. Help launch us into 2016 with your support at thiswayout.org, where you'll find all the details about our year-end campaign. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. The happiest of holidays from all of us to all of you, and thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WEFT Champaign Urbana, Illinois, Planet FM, Auckland, New Zealand, CJMP, Powell River, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, they were working-class immigrants, they hailed from Italy, they were anarchists, and they were women. Together, writes Jennifer Guglielmo, they asked a question that formed the heart of their politics. Why does the pleasure of some have to create misery for many? I'm C.S., the Smith College-based historian, joins me to discuss her book, Living the Revolution, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Of the mass migration of Europeans to the U.S. at the turn of the 20th century, Italians formed the single largest immigrant group. They settled in places like New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, and Chicago, and they brought with them political perspectives and, in some cases, radical sensibilities. Many of these Italian immigrants were drawn specifically to anarchism. They rejected electoral politics and indeed sought the abolition of the nation-state. And although Italians in the U.S. today are generally lumped together with other whites, in the early years, these immigrants were viewed as innately inferior and uncivilized. Jennifer Guglielmo has for many years studied Italian immigrant political cultures, with an emphasis on how they self-organized, what they believed, and how their militancy might inspire political activists and revolutionaries today. Guglielmo is particularly interested in working-class Italian immigrant women who were drawn to anarchism and to a feminism very different from what's called first-wave feminism. Guglielmo is an associate professor of history at Smith College, and she's author of Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. When Jennifer Guglielmo joined me from a studio on the Smith campus, I asked her about the social and economic status of the Italians who immigrated to the U.S.
So Italians who came to the United States, the mass migration occurs from 1870 through the 1920s. And it's a migration that is primarily from southern Italy, from the regions of Calabria and Campania, which is the region around Naples, as well as Sicily. And they migrate to the north. These are folks who are mostly peasants and artisans, and they are migrating to find work primarily. And it's primarily a male migration.
Now, you said migration to the north, to northern Italy?
To North America, to the U.S. And so their migration, the other thing that keep in mind, I think that's really important about Italian migration, is that it is a labor migration. The vast majority are men, up to around 75%. And when women come, and they begin to come in the 20th century in larger numbers, the migration begins to move from one that is kind of highly circular. You know, there's the rates of return are very high for Italian immigrants to the U.S. Over half return back to Italy. So the migration is very much characterized in the beginning from the 1870s through the 19-teens, really, by men migrating in search of work for periods of anywhere from a year to a couple of years, or even up to, some folks talk about going for 7, 8, 9 years. You know, they're working largely in construction or agriculture or manufacturing, and then they return back, send their wages home, and then return back to Italy and then migrate again. And women begin to migrate in the early 20th century, especially because there are jobs now for them too in manufacturing, in garment and textile industries primarily. So that begins their migration en masse. And it also encourages the community as a whole to begin to settle more fully, because you have women coming with children, and so the family kind of location moves from being a transnational family to being located in the United States.
So we can then say that most of these immigrants who did find jobs found kind of low-wage jobs?
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority found low-wage jobs. Those were the only jobs that were really available to them. And these are folks who, you know, who had done apprenticeships and different kinds of work at home to prepare for the migration and to prepare for the labor market. But, you know, the kinds of jobs that they were being recruited for were the lowest paid, the most dangerous, the most stigmatized in some ways, right? These are folks who are building tunnels and bridges and skyscrapers and railroads. And these are the women who are, and men who are entering the garment industry at the lowest level of the trade or the textile industry. And then some are being recruited as skilled workers, but it's, they're in the minority.
How were Italian immigrants to the U.S. generally looked upon?
They were typically, you know, the ideas about Southern Italians that formed throughout Europe in this period really traveled with them. You know, they were thought of as being racially inferior to other Europeans. They were seen as being kind of racially mixed because of the multiple histories of migrations and conquests in Southern Italy. You know, Southern Italy is a land of Arab, Norman, African, Greek, so many different influences. So there was this sense of this community of the Southern Italians as being racially inferior, as being racially other, and as close to Africa. And there was a saying that Africa begins south of Rome. And so these ideas of racial inferiority were, of course, circulating around the globe at this time. In the late 19th century, you know, there was a race science emerging to justify kind of racial categorization and hierarchy that located some people at the bottom and some people at the top. And those ideologies gave shape to a range of practices that kept such groups enslaved, as in the case of Africans, or in the case of indigenous peoples, justified the expropriation of their lands and practices of genocide. And for Southern Italians, you know, in that historical context, what it meant for them was that they were seen as particularly suited to very grueling kinds of labor. They were seen as kind of innately inclined to being able to do very arduous physical tasks, tasks that, you know, men and women from the more well-respected races, right, of Northern Europe were not seen as, you know, capable of doing. And those ideologies, they also shaped not only a sense of their what they were capable of in terms of their labor, but they also created a sense of them as innately deviant in some ways, too. There was a Cesare Lombroso, who's an Italian criminologist in this period. His ideas became very popular in the 19th century. They circulated all throughout Europe and the U.S., and he did all these studies that were very popular in this period of measuring skulls and doing these kinds of biological analyses of people in order to create an argument for their racial inferiority. And he created, he wrote several books about kind of the inherent criminality and deviance of Southern Italians. So when Southern Italians came to North America, they were greeted by this whole host of ideologies that saw them, you know, as racially unfit, and the question about whether they could become American citizens and really assimilate into the United States was absolutely a question. You know, it wasn't something that was taken for granted. And many people thought that they were not racially suitable to become American. The difference, of course, between what happened to them and what happened to other folks who we now think of as people of color is that There were ultimately no real laws that emerged as a result of those ideologies that put those ideologies into kind of material form. You know, so there weren't systems of exclusion like there were with the Chinese, or systems of racial segregation that there were with Mexicans, with Native Americans, and with African Americans. You know, these ideologies absolutely impacted Italian and Italian Americans' ability to, you know, have class mobility for certain, and the way that they perceived themselves in the U.S. But in the end, their Europeanness won out, and an argument for their being included in American society won out as well as whites.
So in other words, as racially mixed, as viewed as racially mixed, whiteness was seen as part of that mixture. So in some sense, would you say, at least partly, would you say they were Italian immigrants were situated as whites?
I would, yes. I would say, you know, my brother Tom Guglielmo, he's written a book about this called White on Arrival. And his argument is that while there are these ideologies that constructed Italians as Southern Italians as racial inferior were quite powerful and quite popular, that in many ways, in the most significant of ways, they were categorized as whites on arrival. And his book, which won a number of really important awards and has been very well received, so I recommend it to everybody who's really interested in this question of race. Again, it's called White on Arrival. His book looks at, for example, naturalization law. You know, for many groups, the ability to become American was just not permitted, you know, especially for Chinese, for anybody who's deemed non-white, they were not allowed to become American. And so this affected Chinese, Japanese, South Asian, Korean, all Asian immigrants, and many other groups as well. But Italians were located as white, so they were permitted to naturalize and become U.S. citizens. And that's just one example of, and a powerful example, right? Because to become a citizen means you can then own property, you can vote, you imagine yourself as part of the community in a way that's very different from somebody who's not permitted to become a citizen.
Jennifer Guglielmo joins me. She teaches history at Smith College, and she's author of Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Italian immigrant women specifically, you write, were viewed as docile and as dominated by excessively patriarchal men. What explains this stereotype?
Yeah, I mean, that was really at the root of what I tried to get at, because that stereotype was, as I would discover, was shaping the ways in which historical memory was forming about Italian immigrant women and their descendants. That narrative, you know, when I started grad school, that was the dominant narrative in every history book, is that they weren't active. They did not have histories or traditions of resistance, and that unlike the Jewish women to whom they were most often compared because they migrated at the same time to the U.S. and they settled in the same neighborhoods and worked in many of the same jobs, that they were seen as more dominated, more kind of cloistered in their homes and less politically engaged. So I, of course, went in search of trying to understand the origins of that ideology and then, of course, the impact that that ideology had on this history. And I traced the origins of that ideology ultimately to southern Italy and to the kind of state-building project in Italy in the 19th century. So Italy forms as a nation in 1870, and part of that political project is about northern Italian provinces establishing their authority and control over the south. And one of the legitimizing discourses that they use to do that is to argue that Southern Italians aren't capable of their own self-government, that they are in need of a more civilized, in quotes, regime to guide them into modernity. And that's a gendered ideology, and the way in which it gets applied to women is to imagine them as innately passive and as controlled by the men in their communities and as in need of a state to come in and direct them and educate them, and even if, you know, not informally, if, you know, informally. And those ideas about them, and it also justifies, right, their control on some level. You know, Northern Italy sent thousands of troops into the South in order to kind of quell the resistance that they met to this state-building project that ultimately was extracting resources from the South, and in the sense that it was taking land away from people and reappropriating it in different ways. And so people didn't have access to the kinds of resources they needed to survive. And so they were, as you can imagine, they were met with, you know, enormous resistance. People couldn't feed themselves. And, you know, they had wealthy landowners coming in. And the church, of course, was a big part of this, too, taking up big tracts of land and people unable to farm in the way they had been in previously. So there's a whole resistance movement that emerges out of the South in this time to the Italian nation state. And, you know, the state has to justify why it's sending in thousands of troops to quell this resistance. And it does so by saying that these folks are barbarous, that they're uncivilized, that they're in need of control, and that the women in particular are seen as really problematic. And what happens when Italian women begin to migrate to the United States is those ideologies, of course, kind of circulate and come with them. And so the ways in which elites in the U.S. imagine them is as in need of uplift, in need of civilization. And white women at the time were, you know, building an argument for their own inclusion in politics, in formal politics, and in the public sphere. And so part of the way they were building an argument to justify their, you know, to justify suffrage, to justify their activity in their communities, to justify their participation in formal political communities was by saying that they had a particularly kind of gendered role to play and that they could help assimilate the millions of Southern and Eastern Europeans that were pouring into the United States, you know, as well as other projects like to assimilate Native American peoples that were at that same time being put on reservations. And so that, you know, that it's in their interest ultimately, as they imagine it, to argue that these are women who need them to uplift them. And so we see that idea of them as passive and as dominated really grows once they come to the United States.
Let's talk about how Italian immigrants organized themselves or helped their communities in the U.S. You write that the Mutual Aid Society became these immigrants' primary method of self-help and survival in the U.S. Tell us about this.
Yeah, the Mutual Aid Society, as a historian, is to me one of the most interesting manifestations in American history that is so confined to working class history. You don't really see people talking about the mutual aid societies in dominant narratives of American history. And it's a real shame because they were absolutely fundamental to the ways in which working class folks, everyday folks, you know, who were, you know, working class folks were the vast majority of people in the United States. And I think one could still argue that they still are, although the notion of what constitutes a working class has changed. But at the beginning of the 20th century, working class people, you know, there wasn't a system of welfare or state agencies to assist people in any way. And so people had to provide those services for themselves as best they could. And the Mutual Aid Society emerged as a way for working class folks to pool their resources and to provide for themselves. So they provided things like death benefits and insurance and other kinds of forms of mutual aid and support, loans to help people start businesses. And they became kind of the absolute core of almost every working class community in the United States. And it's fascinating to study them, I think, whether it's for Mexican Americans or Chinese immigrants or African Americans or Italians and Jews, any group really, this is really the heart. Sometimes they're called benevolent aid societies. And so these folks pulled their resources, came together, and then these mutual aid societies went in multiple different directions. Some of them took on religious kind of and spiritual kind of purposes. Some of them became patriotic and nationalistic. And some of them became a place for folks to organize around issues of labor. And also not only labor organizations, but also self-help. Like some of these mutual aid societies, especially within the African-American tradition, developed into banks and supermarkets and schools. So a great deal of institution building grew out of them for many communities. And for Italians, like for many other folks, they provided a way into the labor movement. It was the way that folks came together and shared what they were struggling with in their jobs and began to strategize about how to change and affect their working conditions. And then, of course, that led them to connect with other workers and to begin to read and think in larger terms about their struggles they were facing. So then they, you know, many of these mutual aid societies began to establish libraries and study groups and places for folks to educate themselves. They founded newspapers to circulate their ideas. They were really at the heart. They're really at the heart of every working class community. And so to study Italian immigrant political cultures, the Mutual Aid Society is really the building block. It's really the heart of the political culture in this period.
Well, how active were women specifically in the Mutual Aid Societies? And I'm thinking specifically of more of the politically radical types of these societies.
Yeah, so the socialist and anarchist mutual aid societies became, you know, the most popular mutual aid societies among Italian immigrants. And the women they participated in them, I discovered, in ways that were very particular in the sense that it was a very gendered understanding of how you're the role that you played in these circles. The men, for the most part, were the ones who attended the meetings weekly. They were the ones who established the newspapers. They were the ones who built the bookstores. And so they were really the ones who were defining the culture in that way. And the women were participating in aspects of the Mutual Aid Society. They were particularly involved in the theater groups that emerged out of these societies, in forming theater groups and in not only performing locally, but touring also throughout their various regions, you know, in the Northeast. They go from radical community to radical community and would perform. Women were very much a part of that. The women, of course, at the big festivals, you know, there were several festivals that these mutual aid societies would throw every year. The women were, of course, cooking all the food. They were, you know, helping to establish, you know, create the setting, you know, performing musically as well as of poetry, things like that. But they weren't attending the meetings regularly, and they felt in many occasions very marginalized by the larger political culture and by their mutual aid society groups too. So some of them formed their own groups within a kind of female auxiliaries within these groups to create a space for women to come together. In Paterson and in New York City, women formed what was called an anarchist women's group, a Gruppo Femminile di Propaganda, in order to create a space for women because they felt like they were not being heard or taken seriously within this world.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jennifer Guglielmo joins me. She's an associate professor of history at Smith College. She presented a paper about Italian immigrant women's anarchist feminism in the U.S. at the recent North American Anarchist Studies Conference in San Francisco, and she's author of Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. That's published by University of North Carolina Press. We have a link to her faculty page at Smith, as well as to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. So you have these women breaking off, you know, to some degree and forming their own groups. And I want to ask you about the kinds of things these particular radical women advocated for. And maybe we could start here because we hear a lot about feminism at this time. And, you know, often the portrait is middle class or upper class white women in the U.S. So did these particular Italian women, did they seek alliances with what might have been called mainstream feminism, or maybe that's a term we use now, but what is now called mainstream feminism back then?
Yeah, part of one of the things I do as a historian, as a professor of women's history, is to expand the notion of feminist activity in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, because the kind of gravitational pull in the center of this history has been so defined by white middle class women's histories around suffrage and progressive era activism. And it's really I think, contributed to a certain level of invisibility, especially about what working class women, immigrant women, and women of color as a whole were up to in this period, some of whom called themselves feminists, some of whom did not, but were decidedly engaged in kind of an emancipatory politics with their whole communities and were very mindful of what that meant for women in particular. So part of what I'm doing with my work is trying to make visible this world of transnational, multilingual, radical feminism that was very much a part of the turn of the century and that historians have been documenting for several decades, but that still has yet to make it really into mainstream understandings of feminism. And to answer your question more directly, that Italian women were very aware of what the Italian women I'm writing about, the kind of working class immigrant women in the U.S., were very aware of what they called bourgeois feminisms. They read them. They heard about them. They attended talks. They read the pamphlets. They were engaging with that political culture, but they saw themselves as very distinct. You know, they did not seek inclusion in the nation state. They sought to abolish the nation state. So, you know, for the women I'm writing about, right, who were anarchists and socialists, these were where you find feminism in Italian immigrant communities, was in these radical movements. And their feminism was, again, they used the word feminism, but they often used the word emancipation, because what they sought was not to join power, but to completely disrupt it and to completely reimagine the world. You know, they critiqued the state, they critiqued the church, they critiqued capital, and that was the change they were interested in.
That sounds like a very anarchist position. Did these women believe, as some women believed back then, that if females ruled the world, things would be different?
No, they absolutely did not believe that, because so many of the women that, you know, they were very critical of bourgeois feminisms, and they did not see middle class or elite women as their allies in any sense, especially among the first generation. In fact, I discovered that in these two newspapers from Paterson, New Jersey in the early 20th century, this outpouring of women's writing, it didn't make it into the anarchist press very frequently because they were very male kind of dominated spaces. But these newspapers that emerged in Paterson that were edited by a man whose partner, they were edited by Pedro Esteve, who is a Spanish anarchist and journalist and printer, very well known in Spanish kind of language immigrant communities among Puerto Ricans and Cubans and Spaniards, as well as among Italians. And his partner was Maria Roda, who was an Italian immigrant textile worker from the north of Italy, actually. And she was one of the first founders of the women's groups within the anarchist subculture in Paterson. And I think my suspicion is that because of their partnership, and since he was editor at the time and she was clearly devoted to women's emancipation, that they sought that women's writing made it into the newspaper. And what you see in their writing is a real critique of elite women. You know, they see these women as the employing class. You know, there's this beautiful essay by one woman who says, you know, these women who's when their skirts touch ours as we pass in the street, you know, treat us as if we're dirty and disgusting, and yet we're the ones who are producing all the silk and all the lavish fabrics that fill their homes and that adorn them. And so this real sense of frustration with women with whom they were not allied. So they absolutely did not believe that if women ruled the world, things would all be okay. They were committed to a revolution that absolutely included men in multiple ways.
Did these Italian immigrant women like Maria Roda, did they rely for their activism on the established trade union movement?
At first, they did not, because the established trade union movement was formed primarily by and for skilled white workers. So they relied on the revolutionary working class movement that took shape in the early 20th century through the mutual aid societies and then became a much more kind of larger national force through the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which was established in 1905. That was the first, I could say, more formalized structure, if you could even call it that. But it was a more formalized movement that they imagined themselves as a part of. But the formal trade union movement, Italian women really didn't join that movement until the 1930s and 40s, till the Great Depression, until the mass-based worker movements of that period really transformed the trade union movement and brought many more women into that movement and, you know, many more people of color, and completely transformed the union culture as a result.
How about the labor strikes of the early 1900s? How prominent and important were the contributions of Italian immigrant women to those strikes, to that militancy?
Yeah, I think that they begin to see that if they want to organize in their fields, which in the Northeast were primarily garment work and textile work, that the best route for that, especially once the IWW was so targeted by the U.S. government in the first Red Scare of World War I, the IWW is really crushed by the U.S. federal government that seeks to undermine its efforts in every imaginable way because it's becoming more and more popular and powerful. And so offices are being raided, people are being rounded up and detained and thrown into prison. And so the IWW really struggles by the 1920s. And throughout the 19-teens as well, the garment unions and the textile unions have some presence and are beginning to shift and change and admit their lowest wage workers into their unions out of necessity. So the International Ladies Garment Workers, for example, that union, which was really rooted in Jewish radical culture at the early 20th century, by the 19-teens, they realized that they have to begin to mobilize Italians if they want to remain effective, because Italians are just pouring into the industry and the lowest sectors. And so the 1909 strike that most people who've studied women's history hear about, the uprising of 20,000, that's a strike that's primarily Jewish women. Italian women are the strike breakers in that strike. And as a result, folks take a real close look at what needs to happen for the future. So by the 1913 strike, Italian women are much more present. They are now organizers. They're bringing other Italian women into the union. And so 1919 is another big strike for that union. And that brings tens of thousands of Italian women and men into the union. Of course, all unions suffer as a result of corporate capitalist approaches to trying to deal with unions, so that union membership tended to decline in the 20s and also as a result of the Red Scare. But by the 30s, you know, these unions emerge again so powerfully as a result of the Great Depression. So, but the foundations for Italian women's participation in the 30s are definitely laid earlier. And a lot of the organizers who were key to the 1913 and 1919 strikes come directly out of the radical subculture. They are the ones who are in the anarchist and socialist mutual aid societies, who have been organizing for much of their lives. And they become the key folks who help to mobilize those unions in the 19-teens.
That's the voice of Jennifer Guglielmo. She teaches history at Smith College, author of Living the Revolution. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Jennifer. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Jennifer Guglielmo is Associate Professor of History at Smith College. She is co-editor of the volume Are Italians White? How Race is Made in America. And we are talking about her book, Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. So, Jennifer, to what extent did these women in these radical organizations, these organizations formed by themselves, to what extent did they try to call attention to what we now might call the 1% and the degree to which elites lived off the labor of the common worker?
That was the heart of what they were attempting to do, is to make visible the incredibly difficult and demeaning and dehumanizing conditions under which they worked, and the ways in which they were producing and other working class people were producing enormous wealth that they never had access to. You know, you can imagine, these are folks who went into the factory 12 hours a day, often 6 or 7 days a week. They were working in conditions that were, you know, poorly lit, badly ventilated, extremely dangerous. There weren't a lot of labor codes that governed their working conditions, especially in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, and certainly at the end of the 19th century. And they were very low paid, and employers were always trying to find ways to pay them less and less and less. So they had a sense of themselves as part of this kind of army of working people who had to, in order to topple this emerging, as they saw it, kind of industrial capitalist world, had to unite and had to come together. You know, and the industrial workers of the world, their famous motto was, you know, workers of the world unite, the sense that that was the only way that they could even begin to challenge the wealth of capital and its power, was by coming together with one another and calling it out, really calling it out for what it was, you know, a system of profit that required their subjugation.
And one of these radical immigrant women wrote, "Why does the pleasure of some have to create misery for many?" What about nationalism? To what extent did these women, these anarchists, single out nationalism as the problem?
Nationalism was side by side with capitalism as a system of oppression that governed their lives. They believed that nationalism was created to preserve the power of capital, and argued that the boundaries were arbitrary when it came to people and the ways in which people needed to move through space organically, and that these boundaries were erected in order to produce profit, in order to justify the marginalized inclusion of some people, right? You can grant some people citizenship status and deny it others, and those who are denied citizenship status, you know, create a low-wage underclass that will produce even more profit. So they were very aware that nationalism was actually a tool of capitalism and was one of the primary ways that capital created a structure that enabled it to perpetuate itself, right? And this was, of course, visible to everybody and continues to be visible to people when you look at who is occupying the positions of power in the nation, right? Who are the politicians? Who are the people who are successful in getting policies passed, right? They were the folks who were also the capitalists. So to them, they were absolutely intertwined.
And does this play into your argument, which you make very forcefully in the talk you gave at the North American Anarchist Studies Conference, that these women had a distinctly and deeply transnational focus?
Yes, their whole identity and their sense of themselves was very transnational, as it is for migrants today. You know, these are folks who were born in another land who, you know, if we think about it from the women's perspective, the men and their families migrated maybe for a decade before they too migrated. So there was time where the family was, you know, moving across national boundaries, and so their sense of themselves was transnational even before they ever left Italy, because of how much migration shaped their communities. And then once they are migrating, they are working in settings that are with other migrants from all over the world. So their transnational sense only expands as they migrate themselves and meet people who themselves have transnational identities. And that formed, you know, the workers of the world unite was ultimately a transnational kind of imperative, right? The need for workers of the world to come together, to not locate themselves within national boundaries, but to transcend them in order to really challenge global capitalism.
You write that most of the women you are studying, were inspired by an anarcho-syndicalist named Errico Malatesta. What was the thrust of his critique?
Errico Malatesta was an anarchist who, like most anarchists at this time, had this critique of capitalism and nationalism and of the church and of religion, that these are intertwined systems of power that had to be collectively kind of toppled and challenged and critiqued. He also believed in the mobilization of workers through industrial unions. Although many anarchists were very skeptical about unions, that they could also become bureaucratic and hierarchical, and of course, they were right in that some anarchists like Malatesta still believed that some level of organization was critical in order for revolution to occur, that people had to come together in small groups. And that's where the mutual aid societies were really key here, is that kind of formal organization could serve a purpose. And so he spoke to that strand of anarchism that appealed to many Italians that were, of course, organizing in the United States in industrial unions at the time.
Yeah, and in fact, syndicalism refers to the importance of organizations within the workplace, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly.
How about education? How about the way in which girls were brought up, maybe to think of themselves in certain ways? What critique of the educational system did these women develop and publicize?
Well, the educational system was pretty non-existent for Southern Italians in Italy and in the United States. Italians did not value formal education overall. And I'm speaking for those who were not anarchists and socialists. This was, for Southern Italians, these are peasant, working-class people who didn't have access to formal education. Formal education was the preserve, really, of the elite in Italy at the turn of the century. So what education meant to them was, it was usually apprenticeships. That was the form of education that they knew. And it was, sending your daughter to the local seamstress to learn how to sew, or sending your son to the local barber to learn how to cut hair, or, sending your children off to learn how to build things. And, they were trying to prepare their children for the economies, both local and international. And so one of the things that the radical political culture gives to this generation of immigrants is a way to go beyond that, to begin to learn how to read. The vast majority of Italian immigrants were illiterate. So for many, joining the Mutual Aid Society and then becoming active in an anarchist or a socialist circle meant maybe being able to learn how to read and attending lectures and, learning about political philosophies and ideologies from all around the world. It was a very invigorating scene. And I think that's why so many people were drawn to it, was that it spoke to them. It spoke to their hearts. It spoke to their struggles. But it also enabled them to become more than just low-wage workers. They could become creative, intellectual people who participated in the production of knowledge, and that was exciting to a lot of folks. And as a result of that, they began to really reflect on, what have we internalized? What have we learned? What is the education? How have we been socialized? And how is that absolutely critical to revolution, that we think through the ways we've internalized dominant notions that produce our own subjugation? So, for example, the women who wrote these essays in the newspapers that I mentioned talked often about how to encourage women, especially as mothers, to educate their children, to think critically and to not just blindly accept their authority and therefore anybody else's authority. They would say, rather than just demand something from your child, engage them in a conversation, ask them to think about why it is they're approaching something this way or that way. And in that way, they sought to produce a next generation that wasn't just kind of willing to be submissive and blindly follow along, but that had a sense of individuality and a sense of their own inner authority.
My guest is Jennifer Guglielmo. She's Associate Professor of History at Smith College, and we are talking about her book, Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945. Again, we have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You write that for these Italian immigrant women radicals, pleasure was seen as primary. In what sense?
Yeah, I began to discover in looking at their writing and the different ways they were active how important pleasure was to them. And it took many different forms. It was the pleasure of a day of leisure and being able to be among like-minded people and enjoy a play or listen to music and inspire your imagination with dreams of an alternative reality, one that wasn't as oppressive and dehumanizing as the ones in which they found themselves each and every day. It was, you know, the chance to get dressed up and put on a fabulous outfit and go to a picnic and meet up with others and joke around and have a good time and tell stories. And that, you know, for folks, as for all human beings, right, pleasure is what keeps us, you know, the earth is not an easy place to live. The world is enormously challenging, right? It's a painful, it can be very painful, very toxic, extremely disappointing and depressing. And especially for people who have very little access to power, right? And so I became really interested, as many other folks are who study marginalized communities, in the ways people survive and how they find ways to keep their spirits intact and how they find ways to go on and also find ways to resist and create alternative worlds and build alternative possibilities, that pleasure is not only personal but collective. Joy, I guess, is another word one could use. Joy is so deeply significant to the human spirit, and finding ways to create spaces for that is absolutely critical, I think, in the history of all marginalized people.
Emma Goldman, the anarchist firebrand, is famous for, among other things, her advocacy of free love. Did they advocate that?
They did. Anarchists absolutely advocated for free love. They believed that love, like the heart, should be unhindered, that it shouldn't be constrained by religion and the church or by the state. They wanted to create a context in which love could flow more readily between people and between communities. And so most people, I think, limit their understanding of free love to that they believe they could have multiple partners. But that was, you know, the anarchists debated everything. You know, there was no fully agreed upon set of principles except maybe the basic core principles. But they, you know, they talked endlessly about what free love meant. And to some, it meant the ability to have multiple partners. To some, it meant that you could form a relationship with someone, a monogamous relationship, and then when that ceased to be a healthy place for the both of you, and when you, you know, it was no longer teaching you or giving you what you felt was in your best interest, that you would then move on and form another relationship. They wanted to create a world in which people could kind of organically come together and move apart without there being stigma or, you know, grave social consequences.
So we've been talking a lot about history, Jennifer, some important history, some important women and groupings and important ideas. But I have to ask you, what's the significance of the history you've been sharing with us to the, you know, to the current political moment, to the struggles that radicals are involved in today?
Well, I hope that this history, I'm a big believer in history just as sustenance and as a set of, as storytelling, as helping us to survive and also nourishing our imaginations and our spirits as we move through extremely difficult times, that we can turn to the past and the stories of our ancestors as a way of finding a way forward. And, you know, this generation of Italian radicals, because their descendants would really focus their energies on becoming seen as white and begin mobilizing as whites, this history, you know, because it, what it meant to become American really required that they disparage and disregard and erase and hide these histories of radicalism, that I feel, you know, the U.S. history as a whole is kind of built upon a particular narrative that erases these more radical histories. And so bringing them to the surface helps us to think about how, just to be critical of how history has been a tool of the U.S. nation as it has imagined itself in particular ways. And also how these alternative histories and radical histories, working class histories, the ways that they suggest and teach us about how people survived, how they came together, the ways that they built community, how they got their ideas out there, how they were able to, just the kinds of ideas that they circulated, the kinds of visions that they had. I think the heart of the lesson for me, what they've taught me, is how much revolution is both inner and outer, and how much revolution is not something you wait for that will someday happen, that to embrace the present moment as the moment of revolution, that each and every moment presents itself with a chance to create another world and to create another reality. And I think especially now, at a time when we're witnessing how much race and class and other systems of oppression have only grown in some ways and become more deeply entrenched in our world, that to have these stories of the ways people critique them, I think is we need them desperately. I hope that they can be really nourishing for the next generation.
We've been talking a lot about women. Let's talk about a woman, because there are a lot of forceful and really inspiring and charismatic personalities among the figures that you studied. So you referred earlier to Maria Rhoda. She immigrated to New Jersey from Italy in 1893 when she was 15 years old. Tell us about kind of her personality, her sense of politics, and how active she was in trying to rile people up.
Maria Rhoda was an interesting character on so many levels. You know, she became politicized as a child. She worked in the Lake Como area, northern Italy, as a textile worker. Like many in of that generation, she went into textile work very young in order to help support her family. Families needed the labor of, you know, the wages of everybody often. So kids went into wage labor very young. And she became involved in labor strikes as a teenager, as a young teenager. She was imprisoned too for a period. So she became very well known in that local milieu for her, you know, for her audaciousness. You know, she's in her trial when she was sentenced, she apparently kind of gave the judge a piece of her mind, took it as an opportunity to really speak out against the working conditions in her community. So when she migrated to Paterson, New Jersey with her family, there was a group of textile workers from that same region who were there really ready to accept her and to give her another platform there. So she really hit the ground running in the New York metro area and became a celebrated speaker pretty quickly. And Emma Goldman recalls seeing her speak in her memoir and just how she was, you know, electrified the crowd and had a very charismatic presence. And
for Emma Goldman to say something like that about somebody else is interesting.
Yes, exactly.
That says a lot, yeah.
Exactly. And that Emma Goldman kind of fashioned herself as her mentor. You know, she thought, I'm going to take this young woman under my wing and help mentor her. So that too, right? That Emma was enamored. You really see in her memoir that she was very much enamored with Maria Rhoda.
Jennifer Guglielmo, Guglielmo. Author of Living the Revolution, Italian Women's Resistance and Radicalism in New York City, 1880 to 1945, co-editor with Salvatore Salerno of the volume Are Italians White? How Race is Made in America, and associate professor of history at Smith College. Thanks so much, Jennifer, for joining us.
Sure. Thank you so much, CS, for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio. resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. Headlines.
This is Tamer with the radio news about radio waves. The latest debate among candidates for the Democratic nomination for president was held the Saturday night before Christmas, and so virtually no one saw or heard much beside the headlines that Hillary Clinton was calling for a Manhattan Project among tech giants about encryption to prevent terrorists from sending secret messages over the internet.
I would hope that given the extraordinary capacities that the tech community has and the legitimate needs and questions from law enforcement, that there could be a Manhattan-like project, something that would bring the government and the tech communities together to see they're not adversaries. They've got to be partners. It doesn't do anybody any good if terrorists can move toward encrypted communication that no law enforcement agency can break into before or after. There must be some way. I don't know enough about the technology, Martha, to be able to say what it is, but I have a lot of confidence in our tech experts. And maybe the back door is the wrong door, and I understand what Apple and others are saying about that. But I also understand when a law enforcement official charged with the responsibility of preventing attacks, to go back to our early questions, how do we prevent attacks? Well, if we can't know what someone is planning, we are going to have to rely on the neighbor or, you know, the member of the mosque or the teacher, somebody to see something. I just think there's got to be a way, and I would hope that our tech companies would work with government to figure that out. Otherwise, law enforcement is blind. Blind before, blind during, and unfortunately in many instances, blind after. So we always have to balance liberty and security, privacy and safety. But I know that law enforcement needs the tools to keep us safe, and that's what I hope there can be some understanding and cooperation to achieve.
While Clinton's call for a Manhattan Project may have got the headlines, the more telling line may have been, quote, I don't really know, unquote, as it seems like she realizes that, while she wants to demagogue as a candidate, smart voters know that encryption is what keeps your online credit card purchases safe. Clearly, listening to her statement, the woman who may be the next president does not have the magical answer to resolve the debate between privacy and public safety, but hopes that someone in Silicon Valley does. This is Tom Rowe reporting for Waveform Radio and WGXC.